from Louisville, Kentucky. This is live coverage of the 47th Annual ACB Convention. Now, here are your hosts, Chrissy Cochran and Larry Turnbull.
Yes, indeed. Welcome, indeed, to... What are we on? I'm losing track of the days. What are we on? Wednesday, aren't we?
Yeah,
that's good. Right, is your mic up? Give another call.
Yes, it is.
There he goes. Okay, we got some good stuff. And I think what we'll do is give you an update on... Yes. We'll play this, and then we will give you an update on what you're going to hear today. Oh, come on.
Hot topic and getting hotter. Here's your chance to add some sizzle to your life by participating in our online survey and enrolling to win a complete digital lifestyle makeover. Here's what you could win. An Asus 2-pound netbook PC with 1 gigabyte of main memory and an 8 gigabyte SSD drive fully equipped for accessible wireless networking, including Ceratec's award-winning System Access screen reader. A complete Ceratec software as service package including System Access Mobile, 4 years of System Access Mobile Network, and Neo Speech, a HumanWare Victor Stream audiobook player, a Creative Lab Zen Stone MP3 player, and one copy of any Mobile Speak screen reader for your mobile device, courtesy of Code Factory. The Digital Lifestyle Makeover is worth more than $2,000, and all you have to do is answer a few really easy questions. Of course, you don't have to wait to win to get access and be accessible. If you're one of the first 100 people to sign up for Ceratec's 4-year software as service package, we'll send you a Zen Stone MP3 player at no charge. For more information, please visit Ceratec on the web at www.ceratec.com. Access life with Ceratec's digital lifestyle. Start your makeover today. The winner of our Summer Sizzle contest will be drawn on the Sunday after Labor Day on ACB Radio's Marlena program. And the winner must be at home to win.
From ACB Radio, this is a 2008 convention update for Wednesday, July the 9th. All times are in Eastern Daylight Time, 4 hours behind UTC. The 47th Annual National Convention of the American Council of the Blind, theme ACB in the Winner's Circle, is being held until Saturday, July the 12th at the Goldhurst Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky, hosted by the Kentucky Council of the Blind. Today, the exhibit hall will be open for 6 hours from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. When possible, ACB Radio Interactive will be broadcasting live exhibit hall coverage during this time, and you'll be able to interact with the broadcasting team in real time via email or MSN Messenger to request@acbradio.org and the speakeasy chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Broadcasting of today's general business session will commence from the Grand Ballroom at 8:15 a.m. on ACB Radio Mainstream. The pre-convention entertainment will be provided by Louisville native Sandra Williams, and the presiding officer will be ACB Secretary Marlena Lieberg of Burien, Washington. The session will be called to order at 8:30 a.m. by ACB President Mitch Pomerantz of Pasadena, California. The Pledge of Allegiance will be made by Paul Edwards of Miami, Florida, Chair of the Board of Publications. Following this, the invocation will be conducted by Donnie Parrott, Minister at the House of Prayer Church of Annville, Kentucky. You will then hear a welcome by Maury Latour, President of the Bluegrass Council of the Blind, from Lexington, Kentucky. At 8:35 a.m, ACB business will be conducted, consisting of more presentations from the Constitution and Bylaws and Resolutions Committees. At 9:00 a.m, we will hear about the new NAPV/AFB family website from Suzanne Leventia, Executive Director of the National Association of Parents of Children with Visual Impairments, from Watertown, Massachusetts. This will be followed at 9:15 a.m. by Observations on the Status of the Americans with Disabilities Act by Chris Kukiski, an Assistant Legal Counselor at the ADA Policy Division of the U.S. Equal Employment and Opportunities Commission from Washington, District of Columbia. At 9:45 a.m., a speech entitled Building the Dream, Collection Development at Your National Library will be given by two people from Washington, District of Columbia. Frank Kurt Silke, Director of the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, Library of Congress, and Dr. Edward O'Reilly, Collection Development Section Head at the Materials Development Division of the Library of Congress. A short break will occur at 10:30 a.m. Then at 10:45 a.m, Louisville native Mitzi Frieglander, a talking book narrator of the American Printing House for the Blind, will give an encore performance. We will then hear about the Digital TV Converter Box program from Kathy Klaas of Washington, District of Columbia, an ombudsman of the Television Converter Coupon Program at the National Telecommunications and Information Administration at the U.S. Department of Commerce. The final speech of the day, AccessibilityIsARight.org, What It's All About, will be made by Mike Calvo of Orlando, Florida, Chief Executive Officer of Ceratec Corporation. This will be followed by announcements at 11:55 a.m. and the adjournment of the session at midday. Following its adjournment, this session will be repeated continuously on ACB Radio Mainstream until the start of the next session at 8:15 tomorrow morning. During live broadcasts of the general business sessions, you'll be able to interact with the broadcasting team in real time via email or MSN Messenger at convention@acbradio.org and the politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. These services will not be available during repeat broadcasts. In addition to our coverage of the ACB National Convention, Guide Dog Users Incorporated will be broadcasting highlights from their own convention and much more besides on Dog Club Radio, which will be broadcast from 7 o'clock p.m. until 11:30 p.m. on ACB Radio World. For more information, please visit www.gdui.org and www.acbradio.org/world. Please note that all times given are approximate and all information given may change with little or no notice. For more details and the most current information, visit our website at www.acbradio.org, read the convention information at www.acb.org/convention, and keep listening to ACB Radio for more convention updates. ACB Radio, where your listening is our business.
Oh, we will, Matthew, we will, we will. Don't worry about that. There we go. So welcome indeed to the Wednesday session. Entertainment is in progress. Let us pick it up and see how it sounds. Ah. Oh, well, we can do without that, the tapping of microphones and things. But anyway, we've got some good stuff coming ahead, as Matthew just told you.
Dan Dillon?
Don't think the piano is mic'd as it should be, which is why we're not picking up the entertainment as well as we have been in previous conventions. Anyway, we had some thunderstorms yesterday here in beautiful downtown Louisville. I've never seen rain like it, I've got to say. It absolutely poured down. And we're all in the dry and what have you. I don't know how many of you heard the Friends in Art showcase last night, but that was quite good. I like the allusion to the aircraft and sitting in the aircraft.
I'm going to try
to... Oh, mics and things going funny. Let's just pop that back a little. There we go. That's it. So, how do you think it's going, Larry?
I think it's going well.
Good.
Give you a little more.
Enjoyed that Friends in Art. I like the rock simulations they did, like with Werewolves of London and the what was the other one that they did? The first one. I'm trying to remember which song they did.
I can't remember either, I must admit.
Yeah.
But anyway. So we've got some good stuff to look forward to in this session. And just to let you know that over on ACB Radio Interactive later on, we are going to be having a little contest of Spin the Dolphin. Dolphin Systems have a simulated roulette wheel. It's a vertical one. I always thought roulette wheels were horizontal. But anyway, let's not worry about that. And we're going to invite you to write in to answer a very, very simple question. And I mean, you really couldn't get much simpler, I'm telling you. But and then the winner that we draw from the ubiquitous bowler hat will be will have the privilege of one of us, and they may, if they're online, be able to nominate who does it, to spin the wheel and either win a little dolphin or some dolphin products. Dolphin Producer, which puts Word processed documents into Daisy Book format, and there are various other software packages. So it's a good contest to enter, and it's Spin the Dolphin. And we'll tell you more about that as soon as Interactive comes on the air from the convention, from the exhibition hall here in downtown Louisville. We've got about, what have we got? About a couple of minutes to go before we start this session. Ow! That sounded painful. Place is filling up. That one sounded painful. But, anyway. So, I haven't got my... I think we can hear the entertainment a bit better now, so let's go to that.
Not really, I'm here. Check 1, 2.
Oh, you'd be surprised all the technical work that goes into this. Actually, it's quite involved. There we go. Let's leave it with this.
Down by the riverside, I'm gonna laid down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, I'm gonna study war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more, no more, no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. I looked over Jordan, and what did I see? Coming for to carry me home. A band of angels were coming after me. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. If you get there before I do, coming for to carry me home. Tell all my friends I'm a-coming home soon. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, well, first of all, thank you, Sandra Williams, and for wonderful entertainment this morning. And we are now going to call the fourth session of the ACB 2008 convention to order. For our Pledge of Allegiance this morning, a gentleman with perhaps the most recognizable voice in the organization. The most recognizable voices in the organization. The current chair of the Board of Publications, Paul Edwards.
Morning, everyone. Please stand. Now, do be lusty and loud on this. Thank you. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice.
Very good. Please be seated. For this morning's invocation, Jay, I am told there is a speaker problem, the electronic kind, not the human kind. For our invocation this morning, I want to present Donnie Parrott, or Parrett, Minister, House of Prayer, Church, Anvil, Kentucky.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Or may I say, as we do it here in Kentucky, howdy. This is the first convention that I've had the privilege to attend, and it has been absolutely awesome. You guys are wonderful. You really are. One thing that I've noticed, people do things different ways. What works for me might not work for you, and what works for you might not work for someone else. And before I pray, if I may, I would like to share the words of a short poem I heard years ago that sums it up this way. You know, some people say you have to do it this way, and some say you have to do it that way. The title of this poem is simply The Proper Way to Pray. And it says, the proper way for a man to pray, said Deacon Lemuel Keyes, and the only proper attitude is down upon his knees. No, I should say the way to pray, said Reverend Mr. Wise, is standing straight with outstretched arms and solemn upturned eyes. Oh, no, 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 said Elder Snow, such posture is too proud. But a man should pray with eyes fast closed and head contritely bowed. It seems to me his hands should be serenely clasped in front, with both thumbs pointing toward the ground, said Reverend Mr. Blunt. Last year I fell in Hodgkin's well, head first, said Farmer Brown, with both my feet a-sticking up and my head a-pointing down. Now I prayed hard right then and there, best prayer I ever said, the prayingest prayer I ever prayed was standing on my head. Would you bow your head with me for a word of prayer? Heavenly Father, as we come before you, we thank you for this day. We thank you for the many blessings that you've given us. And Father, we thank you for allowing us the privilege, the awesome privilege, to attend this great gathering this week. And Father, I thank you for the American Council for the Blind. As many of us have no vision or very limited vision, Father, we thank you for the ACB that has vision for those without vision. And God, we ask a special blessing upon each of those members that have dedicated their time and their service to such a wonderful organization. Father, we thank you for each one that has traveled to be here this week. Father, we ask that you would just keep your hand upon us as we go through this day. Everything that's said and done, let it be according to your will. Father, I pray that you would just go with us today and throughout the rest of this week, as many will be traveling back to their places where they live. Just keep your hand upon each and every one. And Father, again, we thank you for this awesome opportunity to be here today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, have to fix that later. Are the door prize ladies ready? Fantastic. Let's see if we can do three.
Mr. President.
Who seeks the floor?
Terry Arnold.
Terry.
I'm from the Progressive Chapter of Kansas City, Missouri.
and we have wonderful beef jerky for sale. It's a quarter pound, $5, so if you'd like something to munch on, come over to the Missouri table.
All right, Terry, and you got your plug in, but let me say this. One of the things that I want to try to do is limit those kinds of announcements. We have the newspaper, and we will perhaps, because there are about 904 affiliates who are selling things here this week, and I just want to, I want it to be fair, but I also need to keep things moving. Door prize,
yes.
Door prize Debbie or surprise Susan?
We have both of us.
Oh, good. All right.
We have a Kroger tote bag with some goodies in it. I believe it was donated by the Kentucky Deaf Blind Association, and I haven't said this week, but I'd like to thank everyone who has donated door prizes. Makes people a lot happier.
The winner is Robin Wallen from Missouri.
Robin, are you here? Very good.
Next one is some more maple syrup from Vermont.
Cammy Vladiman from Oklahoma City.
Cammy Vladiman, a member of the ACB board and outgoing president of NABS. Cammy, are you here?
Oh, Cammy is coming a little bit later.
She's got to be in the room, or specifically involved in working on convention matters. Let's draw another door prize or another name.
Lynn Jansen, Cincinnati, Ohio.
All right. These people who insist upon sleeping late. Oh, she's gone. Well, then she can sleep late all she wants. Next.
Okay, Linda Jock from Chester, Pennsylvania.
Linda Jock from Chester, Pennsylvania. Is she here? We will find folks, or a bunch of folks in the room. We will find folks who are here.
Yes.
Next.
Angela Griffiths from California.
Angela Griffith, are you here? Nope. Hurry, hurry.
Winner is Bill Pass from Princeton, New Jersey. Nancy Pendergraft from Huntsville, Alabama. Roger Peterson from Mountain View, California.
Roger's here, I'm sure. Very good. One more, please.
Okay. It's a straw tote bag and a little backpack purse, and that was actually donated by me.
Okay.
Winner is Eldon Cox from Kansas City.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We will try to draw a couple of more before the break, a couple of more after the break, and maybe three more before we recess. We were going to hear, be welcomed by Maury Latour. Can I have order, please? We were going to hear from Maury Latour, president of the Bluegrass Council. Unfortunately, Maury is not able to make the convention for health reasons. He is very sorry about that, so we'll keep him in our thoughts, and we will move along. We're going to conduct some convention business this morning. Let me just say that I'm going to bring on Dr. Otis Stevens first, The two bylaws that were read for the first time on Monday, we ordinarily would have voted on them today. However, it came to my attention that there were not Braille copies made available in the press, in the communications center. I have to remember the modern terminology. So what we are going to do is defer voting on those two bylaws, proposed bylaws changes, until tomorrow. Dr. Stevens has one additional proposed change to the bylaws, which he is going to read now. And then tomorrow morning, we will vote on all three. So let me now present to you for the reading of a proposed amendment to the Constitution and Bylaws, Dr. Otis Stevens.
Good morning, everybody. Let me see if I can get this microphone in a better position. Can you hear me all right now? All right. Now, what we're doing this morning is the first reading of a constitutional provision, the proposed change in the constitutional provision, Article 5, Section C. Now, what I would like to do is read the old language first and then the new language that is proposed. Here's the old language. This is Article 5, Section C. It shall be the duty of the Board of Publications to approve or disapprove employment by the executive director of the editor of the Braille Forum, and to establish editorial standards and policies applicable to all American Council of the Blind communication formats, including but not limited to periodicals, the ACB convention programs, ACB brochures, the ACB website, and ACB radio. Now, the new language that is proposed to be added and that we would vote on tomorrow, Article 5, Section C. For purposes of managing ACB's general discussion online listservs, the board may appoint an individual to serve as list moderator who shall see that these listservs operate in accordance with established policies. Now, pending action on this proposal, we would also like to, it has been suggested, recommended, that Bylaw 6 be deleted entirely. Now, this, of course, would be done pending the outcome of the decision on the first proposed change that I just read to you. So what I'd like to do now, for the record, is to read to you the language of Bylaw 6, which we would act on if the previous language is approved tomorrow. So in order to be able to act on this tomorrow, we need to read it today. This is Bylaw 6, Standing Committees.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
John Huffman from Indiana, also a member of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee.
Yes, Mr.
Huffman. Are we not, in fact, referring to Section O of Bylaw 6?
I'm sorry. You are absolutely right. Section O of Bylaw 6.
Thank you.
Which does indeed eliminate a considerable amount of reading. So, John, I greatly appreciate your correction of my oversight there. We're going to Section O. The best laid plans never work out, you see. Here's Section O. Internet Oversight Committee. Each year, within 60 days after the close of the annual convention, an Internet Oversight Committee shall be appointed, composed of 7 members. 1 member must be a member of the ACB Board of Directors, chosen by that board, and 1 member must be a member of the Board of Publications, chosen by that board. The president shall appoint the remaining members. The chairperson of the committee will be the moderator of one of the ACB online lists and cannot be the president or the member chosen by either the Board of Directors or the Board of Publications. The chairperson of the committee shall serve as an ex officio member of the Board of Publications. The Internet Oversight Committee shall, 1, formulate and promulgate rules by which ACB's online lists are managed, with the primary purpose of such rules being to promote the free exchange of information and to present the American Council of the Blind in a positive manner. 2, advise and assist ACB's list moderators with carrying out the policies set forth by such rules. 3, act as an oversight body, making recommendations to the ACB Board of Directors and the ACB Board of Publications concerning ACB's organizational presence on the Internet. Now, that is the current language of Section O of Bylaw 6. I'll make certain that Braille copies of these proposed changes changes that will be proposed formally are available to everyone.
Mr. President,
by this afternoon. Yes, sir.
Point of clarification, Doug Powell from Virginia.
Yes, sir.
The language for the constitutional change.
Yes.
Is that a substitution or is that an addition to the language that's there?
It is an addition to the language in the present constitutional article.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. President.
All right.
Mr. President.
Who seeks the floor?
This is Darian from Oregon.
Darian.
I have a couple announcements to make.
No, Darian.
No?
You may have missed what I said at the beginning, but we will take announcements before the break.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right. That is... Have you concluded, Otis?
Yes, Mr. President. That's what I have this morning.
Very good. So, again, the 3 proposed amendments to the Constitution and bylaws, you have now heard them. Copies will be available in the Communications Center. Dr. Stevens will arrange for that today. We will vote on them tomorrow. Let me make my usual morning announcement. Again, we have Dina Wilson at the registration table to sign people up for the monthly monetary support program. This is a perfect opportunity. You are here. You're finding out about all the wonderful things that ACB is doing. It should motivate you to move from involved stage to committed stage. So, this is not a good time to be invested, at least in the stock market. Marlena said involved to invested, and so, all right, so please see Dina and sign up or increase or increase your current amount that you are giving to the MMS program, please. I hope we had a good crowd last night to the Sampson Room to provide input to Mr. Whitt from the Bureau of Printing and Engraving. How many folks in the room, just give me a shout-out. How many of you did go last night? Oh, fantastic. He is in booth 72 today. I assume he is signing folks up for the focus groups. So take advantage of that. Let Mr. Whitt and the Bureau of Printing and Engraving know that we are serious about making currency accessible. For about the next 5 to 10 minutes, hopefully not more than that, but we'll see, I'm going to bring on the chair of the ACB Resolutions Committee to bring some resolutions before you. So, Judy Jackson.
Good morning. I want to tell you just a little bit about, just so we can get some of this business out of the way. Resolution 801 has been withdrawn. The basic crux of the resolution is dealing with immediate recognizable aspects that come to you in the mail, and it was talking about affixing some sort of logo or some sort of something to the mail so that you would know that it was an ACB, a piece of ACB mail. The author did choose to withdraw it, so 801 has been withdrawn. The other one is 0809, and it had to do with rehab scholarships. And after discussing with the author and with our scholarship chair about the fact that ACB does, in fact, give scholarships to people who are going into the field of rehabilitation, whether it be through counseling or teaching, the author chose to withdraw that one as well. So 0801 and 0809 have been withdrawn. Now then, for the ones that haven't been withdrawn, this first one that we will be considering is 0803. It's brought to us by the Information Access Committee. And the title of it is Online Distribution of RFBND User Authentication Key. Can you all hear me okay? Because I feel like I'm screaming into this thing because I'm sitting far away. But is this okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Here we go. Whereas recording for the blind and dyslexic, parentheses RFBND, close parentheses, requires that its members obtain and install a user authentication key, UAK, before DAISY formatted digital materials produced by RFBND can be played on the Victor Reader Stream, Bookport, PlexTalk, and other such DAISY-capable devices, and whereas individuals wishing to purchase the UAK are required to wait for a CD to be mailed to them rather than given online access to download such keys and install the UAK at time of purchase, and whereas the CD that RFBND provides directs the user to go online and download the UAK for installation into the DAISY-capable device, and whereas many of RFBND's readers are students whose need for books is urgent, and whereas having to wait for a CD from RFBND causes an unnecessary delay for individuals who have purchased the UAK to access RFBND materials for their DAISY-capable devices. Now, I will also dispense with the boilerplate language again. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the American Council of the Blind that this organization, through its Information Access Committee, engage in discussion with RFB&D to immediately institute changes in the UAK purchasing policies such that members can download and install the UAK at the time of purchase. Be it further resolved that the Information Access Committee strongly urge in writing that RFB&D have these UAK policy changes implemented within 90 days of the close of the 2008 ACB National Convention, and further offer RFB&D that ACB will, through the Braille Forum, ACB Radio, and its listservs, assist RFB&D by publicizing the proposed change in the new UAK purchase policy. The committee recommends a do pass.
All right, we have a motion for a do pass and a second. Is there any discussion?
Madam, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Campbell, it sounds like.
Yes, it is. Ray Campbell from Illinois. Just a couple minor grammatical things. Judy, I think in the first resolve clause, shouldn't it read that this organization engages rather than engage?
Okay. Well, you don't engage as in a discussion.
Okay, English was never my strong suit. And then is it in the second one, same question, shouldn't it be strongly urges instead of urge? Okay.
No.
Same deal?
Yes.
Same deal.
You don't urges.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
Okay. All right. Let's have order. Any other discussion? Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the resolution signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions. The resolution is adopted, and as a former board member for the LA unit of RFB&D, I will be perfectly happy to sign that letter, the cover letter that goes out.
You were going to do it anyway.
I know, well, John Kelly and I have a bit of history. All right, let's do one more, Judy.
All right, give me just a second to bring this one up. Oh, let's... All right. This is Resolution 0810, and it is Stadia accessibility. And basically what that is accessibility to sports and entertainment venues, and this is brought to us or submitted to us by the Bay State Council and the Florida Council of the Blind. Whereas the Americans with Disabilities Act is designed to assure that all people with disabilities have equal access to all events held at stadia, and whereas there are specific needs that blind and visually impaired people have with regard to access to events held in stadia, which are currently not addressed in detail in the law, and whereas there is currently no specific mechanism for developing accommodations that would make attending stadia events more equitable and appropriate for people who are blind or visually impaired, and whereas, in the absence of regulatory detail, all decisions concerning seating and other auxiliary aids and services are made by the operators of facilities, which results in procedures that differ markedly from stadium to stadium. Now, therefore, be it resolved. That the president of this organization, in consultation with the chair of the Environmental Access Committee, shall appoint a task force to develop, within 90 days, a list of appropriate accommodations constituting a model policy that would make the experience of attending stadia events as accessible to blind and visually impaired people as they are for people with other disabilities whose accommodations are typically recognized and included in the design and operation of stadia, And be it further resolved that the officers, directors, and staff of the American Council of the Blind are hereby instructed to collaborate with other organizations of and for the blind to advance the process of getting these model policies adopted at all stadia. The committee recommends a do pass.
We have a motion and a second, and the president has a question for someone either from Florida or Massachusetts. I know that Rick Morin drafted a letter in consultation with both Melanie and myself that stipulated some criteria, and that letter was sent to John Wodatch of the Department of Justice probably within the last 6 weeks to 2 months. So I guess my question is, if we have the criteria that were included in Rick's letter, help me understand the point of establishing a task force.
Mr. President, Paul
Mr. Edwards.
The letter was made available to the Resolutions Committee, and we in fact did have it available if we wanted to use it. I think the feeling of both the folks in Massachusetts and the folks in Florida is that while we are waiting for some clarification from the Department of Justice, we really need to independently develop a set of what we described as model policies that we can utilize in our negotiations with them in order to have a clear idea of precisely which components of accommodations we actually want to see emerge in stadia.
All right. And
Mr. President, this is Bob.
Go ahead.
Sorry,
Bob
this is Bob Hesha. Yes, from Massachusetts.
Yes.
The main purpose of the letter was to sort of open a line with DOJ on this topic. So I think that the letter and the resolution fit together nicely.
And I trust that Mr. Morin's letter would be the basis for developing such criteria.
Yes.
Yeah, he was involved. He was involved in the passages of the resolution and knows what's going on with the term.
Very, very.
Actually,
good.
having spoken with Mr. Cantos of DOJ, he has assured me that he is attempting to set up the meeting and get that done. So.
All right. Very good. I just needed to be clear on where we were headed with this. Any discussion regarding this resolution? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The resolution is adopted. My trusty right-hand parliamentarian tells me I don't have to ask for abstentions here, so we shan't. All right. Thank you, Judy Jackson. We have now addressed six resolutions, including the two that were withdrawn. Let me now bring on to preside for the remainder of the session this morning the Secretary of the American Council of the Blind, certainly a well-known and well-recognized voice on ACB radio. She's the reason that I don't necessarily listen to the first 2 hours of Sunday Night Baseball anymore. Unless, of course, the Dodgers are playing. So let me bring on to preside over the session, Marlena Lieberg.
Okay, so I have to put this down. It is truly an honor to be presiding here today for the first time in my life over an ACB general session, and I thank you for giving me that honor. This morning we're going to hear from a wide range of folks discussing a variety of topics that will, I think, be of interest to everyone. We're going to start by hearing about the new NAPVAFB website, and I went online and looked at that website at about 3:30 this morning, And because I thought if I was going to make this introduction, I'd at least better look at it. And what a website it is. It's just packed with resources for parents, children of all ages. So let me bring on to you Susan LaVenture, sorry, Susan, if I slaughtered your name there, Executive Director of the National Association of Parents of Children with Visual Impairments. And Susan comes from my original home state of Massachusetts. Make Susan welcome.
I hope I didn't mess up your last name.
You didn't. Thank you so much. I always look forward to coming to the ACB convention every year, and it's great seeing everybody. It's just a lot of networking and socializing. It's great fun. For those of you who, you know, just very briefly, who may not have heard of NAPFI, the National Association for Parents of Children with Visual Impairments, we are an organization of parents that provide parent support and education. And we've been doing this for about 30 years now, and we have a network throughout the United States and in 52 countries. I just wanted to mention just three highlights for you to know as resources as you're out there in your ACB state affiliates and you meet families. For you to be aware that we are, we've been having national family conferences at once every 2 years, and it's been building and growing. We just, in last summer, we held a national family conference in Omaha, Nebraska, and we had 700 parents and kids attend from 35 states. It was very successful. We are heading to Costa Mesa, California, July 17th through the 19th, 2009. We will be having our first international family conference because we have families that are coming in from other countries. So we are billing as our first international. It will be in Southern California, and we hope that we can work with in cooperation with the ACB California affiliate to participate and be, you know, a part of our program, which would be great. Also, to let you know as a resource, it's online at afb.org store, A Parent's Guide to Special Education for Children with Visual Impairments. It's another resource that's available that you can let families know about. It's accessible as well. They can buy a hard copy, or if the person's blind, they can have it accessible online. So, and then our third feature, which I'm here today to tell you about, is this new family website, Family Connect, that we've done in partnership with the American Foundation for the Blind and NAPFI. And I have here with me Carl Augusto, President and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind, to tell you more.
Hi, Marlena. How are you? I'm here. They didn't want to put me on the agenda because they didn't think anybody would show up. So I'm here. First of all, cooperating and collaborating with the National Association for Parents of Children with Visual Impairments has been a dream, working with Susan and her team. We launched Family Connect, which is familyconnect.org, in April of this year, and we've received so many plaudits from parents throughout the world in terms of the information that they are receiving, especially with the listservs. And I'm going to get back to Susan to talk about the features in a second. This is part of AFB's initiative to broaden our offerings on the web, starting with Career Connect. Many of you are Career Connect mentors. Then we put Access World on the net free of charge, and many of you read Access World, our monthly technology publication. Then last year we launched Senior Sight for seniors who are experiencing vision seniors who are experiencing vision loss, and this year launched in April Family Connect. We launched in April, so we're really excited about the partnership between NAPFI and AFB. And according to Family Connect, web metrics measuring the extent to which people are on the web and organizations are on the web, we and the two met connect. So we're really excited about the partnership between NAPFI and our link popularity, the extent to which others link to us, and search engine saturation, the extent to which we appear on searches. AFB has a greater presence of AFB and according to the web than any other organization in the world. And we want to be able to... Thank you. And we want to be able to utilize that status to provide more information to blind and visually impaired people. And incidentally, we very healthily link to the American Council of the Blind throughout our website. So let me return now to measuring the Susan to the podium to talk about some of the features of Family Connect. Extent to which, Susan?
I will do it in brief because I know you need to stay right on schedule. But this website was created, but we actually asked the parents. We conducted focus groups throughout the country. We did usability testing throughout the whole. We worked about 18 months in the creation and building of the site. And we actually designed and provide content in the site what parents told us they wanted. And the three main areas they wanted, it's a social network. It's not just...
people are on the web and
a place to get information is we have message boards on the most common causes, eye conditions for childhood blindness and visual impairment, so families can interact and meet each other and talk online and to be able to have something in common with each other. We invite you also, you could go online to just go visit the message boards and see and hear what the parents are saying to each other. We have blogs. I have a blog. You get to visit my blog. It's called A Parent's Voice, a regular blog. We're also going to be doing more creating that the parents themselves can have their own blogs. So it's really this whole area of social networking online. We also have a database based on AFB's Directory of Services and Schools for the Blind throughout the country. ACB is in the directory, so if families are searching, they can find out about ACB, and you have your own profile on our site, and you can also enter in your activities and events that pertain to kids and parents so that parents can receive your information. We also have tons of content. Parents wanted information about age-related information, so whether it's recreation, education, sports, families can find articles. We have articles written by some of the best authors in the country in regards to students with visual impairments and families. This is customized. So just to give you just a little taste, for example, if a parent of a child with glaucoma living in Oklahoma registers on the site and registers for my child's age 5, I live in Oklahoma, we will actually push out information to that family as events or news alerts come about that would be of interest to the family. So it's a great dynamic site. Please visit it. It's also accessible. So go see it. And just, Carl, want to make a closing remark.
Nice little tag team here between Susan and me. I just wanted to say a couple of things about your leaders and their involvement in AFB in case you didn't hear. First of all, at our fall Board of Trustees meeting, one of your leaders, Jeff Tom from California, was elected to our Board of Trustees. At the same meeting, one of your leaders was elected trustee emeritus, which means his term on the board is over, but he's made so many contributions, he will become my boss forever, and that's Brian Charlson from Massachusetts. And then finally, maybe the most significant announcement, we give the Miguel Medal, which is the highest honor AFB gives to an individual who's made significant contributions to the blindness field. I'm very happy to tell you, if you didn't know, that one of your all-time leaders, Leroy Saunders, received the Miguel Medal this past February. I don't know whether, Marlena, we have any time for a question or two about... Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carl.
There goes the plate again. Boy, I never thought I would get to tell Carl Augusto no. That's an amazing thing. Carl and I go back a long time. Don't we? I won't tell if you don't, Carl. All right. Moving right along, we've talked about the website for parents of children with visual impairments, and it seems to me quite a natural progression that we should now look at the protections for all people with visual impairments. Our next speaker is going to speak with us about his observations of the status of the Americans with Disabilities Act. His name is Chris Kaczynski. Chris is the Assistant Legal Counsel in the ADA Policy Division in the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission from Washington, D.C., my next home. Let's bring Chris to the mic. Chris?
Thank you. Oops. I can't hear myself. Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today. I last spoke to this group in 1998. I can't believe it's really been that long ago. The first ACB convention, though, that I attended was in 1982. I was a high school graduating senior, and this was the first place that I came in Atlanta to the convention where I saw real positive blind role models and knew what a blind person could really be. So I thank the ACB for that and for that experience that I had all but 26 years ago. I'm able to say that about more and more things in my life. I want to also acknowledge a couple of people, one who is not here today, but Danny Harder, our district director in our Indianapolis district office at EEOC, who was responsible for making sure that I could get here today. I thought it was real important for someone from EEOC to be talking to this group. And secondly, Susan Ryan, who is with our Louisville office and who for the last 8 years on her own time every year has been coming to ACB conventions as a volunteer. So well, as I said, there's a lot happening since 1998 when I last spoke to this group, and I won't try to go over everything. One thing since that time is we've had one change in administration, and another is already about to occur in the next few months. For the past several years, my office, the Office of Legal Counsel at EEOC, has been involved in efforts to implement what President Bush calls the New Freedom Initiative, or his disability initiative. Part of what we have been doing in connection with that has been a stepped-up outreach and technical assistance effort. Our bread and butter, of course, is our enforcement and litigation, and I'm going to be talking about that. But the New Freedom Initiative has been an important part of what we have been trying to implement through a number of things. We did a series of workshops for small businesses that we defined as businesses between 15 and 100 people. These are the types of businesses that are large enough to be covered by the ADA, but too small to have their own human resources and legal professionals to tell them how to comply. We issued a number of technical assistance documents, some of them on specific kinds of disabilities, because after the Supreme Court issued some decisions in 1999 and then 2002, sort of cutting back on what the definition of disability and narrowing that definition, there's a lot of concern that people with certain types of conditions would not be protected by the law. And we wanted to send the message that yes, there are ways that these individuals are still protected by the ADA, and we wanted to give some practical guidance to employers, to individuals with disabilities, and to even our folks in the field on how to find coverage for these individuals and also issues like reasonable accommodation. The other thing that we did, there was a decision that the Supreme Court issued in 2001 called Garrett, University of Alabama versus Garrett, in which the court talked about the fact that individuals can't bring suits for monetary damages under Title I of the ADA. It did say that the government could bring suits for monetary relief under the ADA. But there was some confusion with this decision. States began to believe that they didn't have to comply with the ADA, that they were no longer had to comply. We issued something called a best practices report on 9 states and what they're doing to promote the hiring and retention of individuals with disabilities in state government jobs. And we hope that was issued in 2005, and we hope that states are using it as a resource to learn from what this collection of 9 states that we studied have done. I want to talk briefly about something before we get into the litigation and enforcement matters. I want to talk about something called the LEAD Initiative. More recently, under the dynamic leadership of one of our commissioners, Christine Griffin, who is herself an individual with a disability and has been involved in advocacy on behalf of individuals with disabilities for most of her career, EEOC has launched the Leadership on the Employment of Adults with Disabilities Initiative, or the LEAD Initiative. This is it's an aggressive, primarily outreach effort to federal agencies in particular. Although federal agencies are supposed to be model employers of people with disabilities under the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, we really haven't been doing a very good job at all when it comes to employing people with targeted or severe disabilities. And yes, this includes people who are blind or have severe vision impairments. Less than 1% of federal employees have targeted disabilities, 0.94%. And the number has declined steadily since the mid-90s. And by the way, in the mid-90s, it wasn't so great either. 1.21% of the federal workforce in 1994 had a targeted disability. The reasons for this decline aren't certain, but the fact that it is a problem is certain. And you know that the problem isn't confined to the federal sector. Some estimates put the number of unemployed persons with disabilities at close to 70%. I've been working in this field in one way or another for over 20 years, and in that time, that number hasn't changed much. True, there are some estimates that by using a different definition or a broader definition of disability that may set the unemployment rate at 40 to 50%. But whether we're talking about 70% or between 40 and 50%, we're talking about a number that we all know is bad and that would be considered a national crisis if it was associated with any other group. So we need to take this, obviously, very seriously. The LEAD Initiative tries to do... The LEAD Initiative tries to do something about this in a few ways. One is that it tries to educate human resources professionals, hiring officials, managers, and supervisors about the Schedule A hiring authority in the federal government. There is a system under which individuals with targeted disabilities, with severe disabilities, who are capable of doing the jobs for which they're applying, can in a sense bypass the normal competitive processes that sometimes disadvantage people with disabilities who have experienced a history of discrimination. Maybe their resumes don't look quite like what a federal manager or supervisor thinks he or she is looking for. This is a system that allows people with severe disabilities to get into government jobs quickly. It's good for federal agencies. It's good for people with disabilities. The problem is agency officials don't know anything about it. They don't know how to use it. The LEAD Initiative is trying to do a lot more when it comes to educating agencies about Schedule A. Second is educating agencies about reasonable accommodation. Educating agencies about reasonable accommodation. Hasn't the federal government had an obligation to accommodate people with disabilities since at least 1973? Well, that's true, but there are things that managers and supervisors, hiring officials, still don't know about reasonable accommodation. A number of years ago, agencies were required to implement procedures, written reasonable accommodation procedures, because the process of providing reasonable accommodation in the federal government was so bad and was so uneven from one agency to another, and even from one department within an agency to another. We know that a lot of accommodations are not expensive. We've heard that. But we also have to admit that some of the accommodations that people who are blind or visually impaired need are a little bit more costly. Now, I haven't heard very many employers raise issues about the cost of any accommodation. They don't do it in the private sector, and we tell federal agencies over and over again it's a losing argument for them. But we know that managers and supervisors who believe that their particular budgets will be affected may be unwilling to consider individuals who are blind or have visual impairments because they're concerned about the effect that the cost of the accommodation will have on their budget. There's a program called the CAP program that the Department of Defense runs. Now, most federal agencies have contracts with the CAP program, the Computer and Electronic Accommodations Program, through which agencies can purchase these more costly accommodations by using the resources of the Department of Defense. They don't have to use their own resources. Problem, again, is agencies aren't aware of the CAP program. I get a lot of my own accommodations through the CAP program, like JAWS and a Braille Embosser and things of that nature. A lot of agency officials don't know that the CAP program even exists or how to make use of it. In December 2007, again, in connection with the LEAD initiative, Commissioner Griffin announced the goal of 2% by 2010. What does it mean? It means that agencies should set a goal of hiring, because a lot of these things don't work unless you have goals and accountability. Set a goal of hiring 2% of individuals with targeted disabilities or with severe disabilities in your agency. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. But if agencies took the goal seriously, and the head of the Office of Personnel Management has also signed on to this goal of 2% by 2020. It's an aspirational goal. There are no enforcement mechanisms in place. But if agencies take it seriously, and if they really try to do this, we will double the number of people with targeted disabilities in the federal government. Now, in addition to these efforts, we have continued to enforce, and I said these are our bread and butter issues, the Americans with Disabilities Act by processing charges and through litigation. Let me give you an idea of the number of ADA charges we receive annually and the percentages of charges that involve people with vision impairments. The most notable fact about our charges under the ADA is that they've increased dramatically over the past year. Beginning in 1999, when the Supreme Court decided three cases that limited the definition of disability, the charges began to decline. In fiscal year 2006, that means from October 1 of 2005 through September 30th of 2006, which is how we track our data by fiscal year, the number of ADA charges increased by about 700 over the previous year. That was the first sort of uptick in charges that we saw under the ADA for about 7 years. But in fiscal year 2007, the increase was far more dramatic. We received 17,734 charges, up more than 2,200 or 14% from the previous year. In a sense, this really reflects the upward trend we've seen in charges under all of the statutes we enforce. They're up by about 9% this year over the previous year, and they're running at a pace this year. We don't have the data for current fiscal year 2008, but people tell me that they're running at a pace to even increase again over the 2007 figures. The percentages of our charges that involve persons with vision impairments has remained relatively constant over the years. Somewhere between 2.3 and 2.6% of all ADA charges are filed by individuals claiming discrimination on the basis of some vision impairment. In fiscal year 2007, the number of charges from people with vision impairments increased by 100 from 355 to 455. Over the previous year. Overall, since Title I of the ADA became effective, we've received 6,287 charges out of more than 253,000. The 6,287 are from people with blindness or vision impairments. So that's how the statistics look. The charge statistics, though, don't tell the individual stories. And I'm going to tell you a few things that we've litigated, because these are the things I can talk about. The charge processing is confidential, but I can talk about cases that we've litigated or that we've settled after litigation. First of all, I would have thought, and I'll give you about four or five examples. First of all, I would have thought that allowing someone to use a guide dog, right, was something that businesses were fairly familiar with by now, right? Sure, you know, maybe they're confused about dogs that seem to do other things, like for people with hearing or seizure disorders, and there are dogs that do that. Maybe they don't understand that there are animals other than dogs that people use for disabilities, and I won't get into some of those issues. But guide dog users who are blind, I would have thought that this issue was behind us. Sure enough, we filed a case in Phoenix, in our Phoenix office, against AutoZone on behalf of an employee who is blind and who was given time off to train a guide dog, only to be told when he returned that he couldn't keep it at work. And the employer is arguing that the employee, the employee had demonstrated this when he didn't have the dog, that he was capable of performing the functions of his job without the dog. That's one example. You know, what happens when the person wants to move from one place to another in the workplace? What happens in the event of an emergency? What happens when the person wants to do the kind of normal interactions, going out to lunch, interacting with coworkers, all kinds of things, getting to and from the job, obviously. But this is an interesting case, and I've seen and have heard about a few of these types of cases out in the field now where employers are saying you don't need the dog in order to perform the job. Now, another question. Why would an employer fire someone with more, a good employee with more than 36 or 30 years of experience, when she could have continued working if she had a simple accommodation? But that's what happened to Helen Werman, an employee with a Cleveland-based company called a packaging company who had diabetic retinopathy. Now, we argued that the company could have accommodated Ms. Werman by allowing her to use some kind of magnifying device to read labels on packages. This is a 30-year employee. The company said no. The company denied the accommodation, terminated her, and paid $120,000 in a settlement with the EEOC for doing that. That's a significant amount of money because damages are capped under the ADA. So when we're talking about and other civil rights laws. So we're talking about a $120,000 settlement for this type of action. It's significant. Now, sometimes a person who is working successfully in a job finds himself or herself out of work when a new manager, and in some cases when involving blind employees, new technology is introduced into the picture. So this is someone working successfully who now, because of new management or new technology, is not able to work anymore. Last July, we filed suit on behalf of Peter Gillard, who worked as a switchboard operator with a golf and ski resort in Michigan for 5 years, worked successfully for 5 years. When the facility became associated with Marriott International Corporation, his position was given the title of Delighted to Serve Agent. Delighted to Serve. Although the duties essentially remained the same, there were two things that were different. There was one piece of technology that required him to read a caller ID screen that showed the name of the person calling from a room so that when the person calls, the Delighted to Serve agent can say, "Hello, Mr. Kaczynski," without my having to say what my name is. So that was one thing that he couldn't do. And the other thing that he was not able to do was enter in, at least as the technology was currently configured, was unable to enter in food orders for room service into a point-of-sale technology that he was required to use. Without making accommodations or even considering accommodations for those positions, he was terminated from a job that he had performed successfully for 5 years. Just 2 months ago, we filed suit against a Wausau, Wisconsin facility that sold books and tobacco products because after 1 day on a job, it terminated someone with retinitis pigmentosa who had somewhat of a limited peripheral vision because of concerns that he could not adequately monitor the store. They never asked, the supervisor never asked him how he would have performed the job. In September of 2007, we filed suit against, and this is the last one, Cypress Media Group doing business as the Belleville News Democrat for refusing to employ someone in its print facility who had years of experience in industrial settings because they were concerned that he couldn't safely operate the equipment and never bothered to find out. Now, I could give other examples from these five, but I think that this gives you some idea that we're pretty active in the field of trying to seek relief on behalf of individuals who are blind or have vision impairments, because this is the we bring about 40 ADA lawsuits in a year, and we have five or so in the last year that we have either filed or settled that involve people who are blind or have vision impairments. Yet there is more to be done. I'm sure many of you can tell me stories about charges that have been filed and took a long time to resolve. Charges that were dismissed, that you thought you lacked confidence in the EEOC. Let me tell you that I understand all of these concerns. I'm not one of those people who shrinks from criticism because I know that an organization like yours isn't doing its job if it doesn't challenge us to do better and to and improve on what we're doing. We're continuing to try and do more with less. We do have fewer resources now than we had 10 years ago. One of the things we're trying to do is more systemic litigation, cases in which we can have an impact not just for one person, although those cases are important, but cases in which we can have a broad impact on a number of employees across a broad industry. Some people think the ADA isn't particularly well-suited for systemic cases. I disagree with that. I think we need to be doing big impact cases involving the ADA that get broad-based relief for lots and lots of people with disabilities, and I hope we do that. We're going to have additional responsibilities in the coming year. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act was passed on May 21st, 2008, and we need to issue regulations within a year to implement that law, and we need to begin enforcing that new law on November 21st of 2009. We don't know whether we're going to get more resources to do that. Additionally, the ADA Restoration Act, or the ADA Amendments Act, was approved 402-17 in the House of Representatives. If it becomes law, we'll have to make dramatic changes in the way that we enforce the ADA and in our regulations. You have doubtless... through all of these changes we are experiencing, we need to hear from you. If you believe you have experienced employment discrimination, we need to know about it. Because even though we have the power to issue commissioner's charges or do systemic cases, primarily what we do is charge-driven. We need to hear from you. We want to work with you. And I thank you all for listening to me this morning. Thank you very much.
We will have time for two questions.
Yes, may I make a comment question?
Okay. The lady in the back, I believe, who has a comment or a question?
Yes, yes. Oh, thank you.
And who is speaking?
This is Renee Zellickson, and thank you very much. I would like to ask how it would be felt if we had a resolution whereby the government be made to accept the responsibility that they need to be able to be sued for punitive damages. I had an EEO case, okay, and it was settled.
Can we let Chris answer your question?
But the government is exempt from punitive damages, and I think that because there is an ongoing thrust of this, the only way that it can be solved is if...
Okay, let's let Chris answer your question.
I think...
No, I'm sure.
That's okay. I think You know, to try to answer it quickly, I think some of the issues may be more complicated than either doing an executive order or passing a piece of legislation. Some of them are constitutional issues. For example, individual suits under Title I of the ADA can't be brought. I don't believe that there's a fix to that issue without a constitutional change, quite frankly, or without a different composition of the Supreme Court that would interpret the issue differently. So, you know, some of the issues are probably more difficult to fix than just passing a piece of legislation. They have to do with passing legislation, having a different composition on the court, and maybe some constitutional innovation. So it's a complex area.
Dan Kaiser. Richard Villa from Texas.
I heard Dan first. Dan will be the final question.
Thank you, Marlena. Chris, I'm from California. And in California, the Superior Court, if the damages are at least $7,000, it would be handled by the small claims courts. And so it seems like every time I bring a taxi cab discrimination case related to my guide dog, I lose. This has happened three times now. And so what can I do to win?
Well, these are cases that go into small claims court. Like, that's Judge Judy.
I wish I had Judge Judy.
Yeah, I think she would go after a taxi cab driver
who discriminated. Yeah, I wasn't that lucky.
You know, these cases, if they're brought under Title III of the ADA, if you bring them under state law, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, because state law, you know, has its own, like you're talking about $7,000 limit that goes into small claims court. State law probably has its own enforcement procedures and its own damages, its own remedies. Under Title III of the ADA, which I'm not really speaking on today, but I know about it from my work in the Justice Department, damages aren't even available in those cases. You can get some injunctive relief. I don't know about the facts of the individual cases that you're bringing, and so I don't know why you're not prevailing in them.
They just don't pick you up with the dog and
right.
You have witnesses.
Yeah, we can talk about it. When I'm done here.
Okay, thanks.
I'll be around for a little while.
All right. Let's give Chris a nice round of applause. And is Kurt here? Is Kurt up here? Okay, great. All right. Oh, of course. Here, get your papers. I put my Braille note down on top of Chris's Braille. Oh, and now I'm standing on his cane. I really give our speakers a good ACB welcome, don't I?
Just to let you know that the chat room is open, but if you're going to use it, please keep your comments convention related. Nothing to do with my mic isn't working or anything, or how's it going, or what. Anything you have a question for the convention or convention related, by all means come into the chat room at ourplace.ecbradio.org in the politics room. Now back to Marlena holding court.
And now we're going to talk about our library. And I don't know about you guys. How many of you guys love our libraries? How many of you guys spend weekends with Braille and talking books? And how many of you guys would be lost without our National Library Service? Building the dream, collection development at your National Library is something that is just a valuable thing to me and to all of you. And so to discuss that with us, it is my honor to bring you Frank Kurt Silke, director. Go ahead. Director of the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped Library of Congress, Washington, D.C., and Dr. Edmund O'Reilly, Collection Development Section Head of the Materials Development Division of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Kurt, I give you the floor, and convention, I give you Kurt Silke.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think you're in for a treat this morning, and that treat will be hearing Ed O'Reilly give a speech. I carry Ed O'Reilly around with me, not in my pocket, but... Being half Irish on my mother's side, I like to have leprechauns around. And I think you'll perceive Ed as a leprechaun after he makes his presentation. But in addition to Ed this week, Freddie Pico joined me here. And she, as you know, has been at the booth now for, some 20 years at your conventions. Judy Dixon, our consumer relations officer, is also here. And Judy's been with us for years. And I believe there'll be a new person, Neil Bernstein, who's our research and development officer. Neil is the fellow who's been running the download pilot, for those of you who have been involved in that. And I think when you say you love the library, we love you too. And I better get away from that before I go on too much. Now, what I'm going to make a very few remarks before the before Ed speaks, but let me say that it's a very good week for us. 2 weeks ago, we signed a contract with the Shinano Kensei Corporation, and those of you who know what their second name is, it's Plexstore. So we've signed a contract with Plexstore to produce the digital talking book machine. We've signed a contract which can be extended through 7 years. The first year is funded at the rate of $35,013,260. And that will permit us to buy approximately 200 pre-launch machines for the testing, 5,000 for an initial runout, and a total of 217,637 machines. The contract, well, it gets better than that. The contract, based on the satisfactory performance of Plexstore, can remain as long as 7 years and produce 600,000 machines. It's basically a $100 million contract. The cost of the machines, $154. That beat our price by $50. We thought they'd be about $200, and the machines are expected to last approximately 10 years. Now, we've also signed a contract with an organization, LC Industries. LC does not mean Library of Congress. It's down in Hazelhurst, Mississippi. They are producing the containers in which the cartridges will be placed. And they have a contract for $500,000 to produce as many as we actually need. And the book itself, the cartridge contract, will be signed either by day after tomorrow or early next week. So we are in business. We plan to have a kickoff and a launch in December of this year. The Plexstore people came in on last Monday and Tuesday, and I chatted with them on Monday. They predict that they'll be ready to start in November of this year. So that's somewhat optimistic, but I believe you're going to find yourself in very good shape. Now, bear in mind that we have been running a download pilot, as you recognized a few moments ago, and that pilot will be expanded to include everyone and cease being a pilot in December of this year when our machines are available. So there you go. The only other thing I would say is that our long-range plans involve bringing Web Braille into the download project so you can have a one-stop shop.
And now we're going
to a situation for those who wish to use that service. Those who don't, you will receive the same type of service as you did before with the cartridges, flash cartridges, being sent to you at home. Now, those are my very few remarks. I'd like to introduce Ed O'Reilly. Ed is the head of our collection development section. He is an articulate fellow. He's quite an intellectual, has a PhD in folklore studies, has worked for us, took a brief sabbatical, went to work for the BBC in London, came back, assumed the head of our collection development section, and I think he's well on the way to making a long and illustrious career here. I say to Ed that he, you know, when I was in school, I'm sure when you were there, you took these tests, and they had you putting square blocks in round holes and round holes in square blocks, or at least that's what I did. He is a round hole
He's not a hole. He's the round plug that fits into the round hole. But that simply refers to him in his intellectual capacity, because Ed comes to, I think he, at least he appears to me to be 6'8", weighs 150 pounds, and so he's not a round person at all, but well-rounded intellectually. Thank you. I'd like to introduce Ed O'Reilly.
Thank you, I think. I said, they say Dr. O'Reilly. I'm tempted to say, take two of these and call me in the morning. I'm the other kind of doctor, and when people hear that I have a doctorate in folklore, they start asking me questions about gnomes. This is my second trip. Just a brief digression. Actually, this whole talk is going to be a digression, but never mind that. You'll see that after the fact. This is my second trip to Kentucky. My first was to the other end of the state, down to Harlan and Hazard. I wanted to, as a folklore student.
Hello.
I'd always wanted to visit that part of the country, and I got very interested at one point. There was a lot of trouble, as you, some of you undoubtedly know, in the mines in the early 1930s, toward the end of the 20s and the 30s, throughout the 20s, throughout the 10s and the 20s, into the Depression, and it, some of it continues to this day. But in the 30s, early 30s, there was a particularly violent upheaval right around down in Harlan, and a town called Pineville was there. I wanted to visit. There was a fascinating incident. A group of people, including Theodore Dreiser, the novelist who wrote Sister Carrie and An American Tragedy, and some literary critic, Edmund Wilson, whom some of you may recall. He's not so well known now, but in the 50s, he sort of towered over American literary journalism. A fellow named Malcolm Cowley, also a literary journalist. John Hammond, who later became the head of Columbia Records and introduced, made his mark with a concert at Carnegie Hall called Spirituals to Swing that kind of brought jazz and blues and a wide variety of black music into the American mainstream. That was, I think, in the 40s that concert was held. And he was producing people like Bessie Smith, the great blues singer, and others less well-known. And later in life, he was responsible for bringing us Bob Dylan and Springsteen, just a brilliant and important musical entrepreneur. He was involved in this group, and another novelist named Waldo Frank. Anyway, all these people lived in New York. They were New York City intellectuals, and they were, I think the term of choice is flirting with communism. Some of them were members of the party, and some were fellow travelers. But they all got together and decided to visit Harlan and visit Pineville, Kentucky. There was a hotel, something like the Galt House in Pineville at that time, although I understand the elevators worked better.
It's about our library. And I don't know about you...
Hey, I'm sorry. I apologize. That's biting the hand, isn't it? These people formed, it was called the Dreiser Committee because Theodore Dreiser was the most illustrious name among them. And they went down to Pineville to see what was going on, and they held a hearing in a local church.
You guys love our libraries.
Church. And...
How many
interviewed a lot of miners and
the guys spend weeks
and people who worked in the community
with Braille and talking books.
One of them was Aunt Molly Jackson.
And how many of you guys would be lost without our...
Who...
the library.
Was a singer. She...
Service.
Made up songs about mining. Kind of anti...
building the...
Anti-establishment songs, pro-mine...
Dream.
Worker songs.
Action development at...
Which
our national
side are you on? Join the NMU. Songs that fired people up, and she sang them at this hearing that Theodore Dreiser arranged. And was later she was a midwife, I believe, in the community nurse midwife, not well educated, but sharp as a tack very, very, very engaged. Aunt Molly was later recruited by the communists up around New York City as a sort of celebrity spokesperson to go around and agitate, be the entertainment at meetings. And some of that tradition is carried on to this day. This all issued in a book, a Theodore Dreiser book called Harlan Miners Speak. And whether or not something came of it immediately, I can't say. The strike in question was lost in the short term, but ultimately the miners did get some safety considerations, and their unity persisted. So there's a lesson here. There's a tangential relationship. I don't need to point it out. So this is my second trip to Kentucky, other end of the state, top end of the state. The Pineville Hotel was torn down, by the way, when I got there. It was sort of disappointing. But I did see the site of a gun battle. And actually, Dreiser, excuse me, Dreiser, the local sheriff, they were trying to get these people out of town. And Theodore Dreiser was traveling around with his secretary, quote, secretary, and they saw her going into his room late at night, and they leaned toothpicks against the base of the door. And in the morning, they went and checked, and the toothpicks were still there. So they told Dreiser to get out of town forthwith, would be arrested for public lewdness and immoral acts. And Waldo Frank, the novelist, was beaten up and taken to the state line and dumped. It was not pretty. We have better ways of handling these things today. Little glimpse behind the scenes here. I was invited to our illustrious director's office 6 months ago or so. Probably trying to find out if we had enough money to buy binder clips. Or whether we were going to get funded for the operations of NLS for the next year. And he said that I was going to speak at the ACB convention this year, and said that they haven't collectively met you, and it would be good. It would be a good social event and an informative occasion for all. And he said, what do you want to call your speech? He said, into the digital future? He said, no, we used that for the NLS conference. Facing the digital millennium? No, that sounds too much like our recent, the book Judy Dixon edited, Braille into the next millennium. That's been used, and besides, it sounds too apocalyptic, and we don't want to offend the secular humanists. He said, how about building the dream? That's good. That's really good, building the dream. So what do you want to call your speech? So I hesitated appropriately, being, as the director has noted on occasion, an obsequious fellow. And I said, well, how about building the dream? And he said, that's good. That's good. I like it. So this is called Building the Dream, and it has nothing to do with Cary Grant's architectural misadventures in the 1940s screwball comedy. And it doesn't have much to do with Martin Luther King's vision of equity or with Shakespeare's Arcadian revelry outside the city of Athens. And in fact, I don't know exactly what the director had in mind, but we have a couple of ideas of our own about the dream, or the dreams. There's more than one. The first is, of course, the idea that's animated the National Library Service from the very beginning, and that's simply, maybe not so simply, but it's simply stated to support the aspirations and, more important, the rights of blind and visually impaired and physically disabled people in this nation to have the same access to books and printed materials as any other member of the society. Since NLS came together more or less in its present form back in the 30s, I think we collectively can claim some success in helping to make that happen. We have a good collection, currently more than 73,000 recorded book titles and 61,000 Braille items, 10 or 12, maybe Judy can help me, items on web Braille at the moment.
10 or 12 items?
10 or 12,000. What? Do we have a number? Okay, a little over 10,000. And that's growing every day. And what's that? Well, yes, there's some consternation about that. But, yeah, Web Braille, I think Web Braille has, it still grows every day. You just don't get the numbers. We're working, we haven't cut down our work schedule to Fridays only. There are also about 19,000 music scores, and I think we have about 1,400 print Braille books, which are mostly for children and adults to share. We have magazines, tactile maps, and there's much, much more through the portal of our union catalog. I think we're prepared to admit that interlibrary loan, especially internationally, isn't altogether dependable, and it's not as speedy as the Pony Express or even the average three-toed sloth. But our libraries try, and patience is frequently, if not always, rewarded. Patience is a prerequisite for book collecting and book acquisition and government work and fishing and bird watching and courtship. Not necessarily in that order. In Washington at the moment, we have about 125 people on the staff, and of course around the country, the staffs of our very wonderful network of state libraries, and they're making all this happen. And by all this, I mean the production of new books and the circulation in an ordinary year of something like 27 million items. This is an inconceivable number to me, the stuff that dreams are made of. There is some not so good news mixed in here. The number of libraries in our network is smaller than it used to be. We're down to, I think it's 127, which is down about maybe 20 from when I started back in the 90s. I began life in the publications and media section, so you can blame me for errors in talking book topics and Braille Book Review, as well as problems with the collection. Governments, from the federal down through state and local, are chopping discretionary funds for all kinds of enrichment activities, reading, education, art, music, you know the litany, the inessential things that nobody cares about. And it's not just blind folks who are getting hit in this way. It feels like a war on art and culture and reading and education, and it's being waged democratically with only the very rich accepted. And they often have other interests, such as golf and destabilizing small autocracies and burrowing through their money like Uncle Scrooge. Opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of the Library of Congress. You may know that we select and produce about 2,500 books a year, and that breaks down. That's both Braille and audio. We select around 2,000 books for audio production and between 500 and 600 for Braille. There are a couple of reasons for this apparent discrepancy. One is that a cassette book with container costs a little more than $5 per copy, and a Braille book costs almost $100 a copy. We could bring that down a little with massive production, but the fact of the matter is that only about 5% of our enrollment consists of Braille readers.
Hold your questions.
I'll get back to that. The short answer is no. We average 55 Braille books, book copies for each pressing, and around 96 recorded cassette copies for initial distribution. There's another fact. I don't know whether it's sad or disturbing or weirdly fascinating, but I've learned recently that the number of books published in the United States annually is staggering. We had some early literature, and we've been cavalierly flinging the figure around for a number of years, that there are 40,000 books published annually in the United States. And therefore, at 2,000 books a year, we could claim we skimmed off the top, say, the top 5%. But the number is, that number was wrong. That was a number that somebody derived in, 1982 and wasn't looked at again. Right now, it's somewhere between 200 and 300,000 books published annually. And that means with our 2,500 books a year, we're somewhere between 2/3 of 1% and 1% of published books. So that's one answer to the question, why can't you make everyone happy? Our selection policy, I think we'll have a Library Users of America meeting scheduled for this afternoon, and we can go into this in greater detail. But our selection policy, in a nutshell, is fairly simple and straightforward. We look at bestseller lists. We look at librarians' tools, library journal publications such as Locus, which lists science fiction, Romantic Times, which is a librarian's guide to buying romances, and there's one for mysteries too. I've forgotten the title. Choice. The lists that are in the national newspapers of record, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and we look at several online sources. We have a collection development advisory group. More about that in a minute. We do pay attention to patron requests. And we get a lot of them that arrive by email or by telephone, and we evaluate them. We don't automatically produce a book that's requested by a patron. We can't do, there would be no other books if we did only patron requests. Frequently, patron requests, I'm happy to say, anticipate books that are already in the pipeline, however. They're often the next item in a series, for instance, and we try to keep up with our series books and favorite writers who are cranking them out regularly. I think in the Pacific Northwest, somebody did a study, the Western Conference, and the top four titles in popularity were all written by Danielle Steele. So we do try to that's good news and bad news. I don't know how to think about that. Being an ivory tower intellectual, I'm a little bit squeamish. But I'm glad people are reading. Our collection development group consists of representatives of this organization and another consumer group that will remain nameless, the Blinded Veterans Association, and patrons from each of the four regional conferences of librarians. And they come together annually and sit around and talk for 2.5 days and make recommendations specifically about the collection. And that information is distilled and responded to and put out to the libraries around the country. When I think about the digital future, and this is maybe the second dream here, I become more encouraged about the prospects for reading. We've been promised and have promised in turn a great deal of the digital revolution. It's important to remain patient because we're not just in the midst of a consumer innovation like the introduction of instant pudding at the supermarket, but are rather making our way into a whole new way of life and thought. Digital books on flash memory cartridge, or online for that matter, are just a start. In time, maybe after some of us, including me, are gone, reading itself may have new and different meanings. There's a huge literature that's emerging in the world discussion of exactly what this digital revolution means. A lot of it's negative. The current Atlantic Monthly, which I have in my hand here, has a cover article called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And they've spelled it. The graphic on the cover has the two O's in Google are used in the word stupid. The U in stupid is replaced with the Google double O. Fellow named Nicholas Carr, and he has some concerns. He doesn't hate Google. He's not against it, but he's afraid that this is taking away from reflection and immersion in a book, reading at depth, that we're all just whipping through data superficially without paying the right kind of attention, without thinking about what it is we're reading. I don't know if that's the case or not. There's also a fellow named Steve Wasserman who used to edit the LA Times Book Review, and one of the symptoms that's troubling book publishing in America today is that the book review sections are not making any money, and there a lot of cases they're folding up. The LA Times used to have a tabloid book review, and it's now become a feature, I think, of the Saturday life and living section or whatever they call those feature pages. But I'll just read you a paragraph from a longish article by Steve Wasserman called "Goodbye to All That." his response to his book review being cut back. He says, "The terrible irony is that at the dawn of an era of almost magical technology, with the potential of deepening the implicit democratic promise of mass literacy, we also totter on the edge of an abyss of profound cultural neglect. One is reminded of Philip Roth's old aphorism about communism and the West. In the East, nothing is permitted and everything matters. In the West, everything is permitted and nothing matters. In today's Mac world, In today's Mac world, the forces seeking to enroll the populace in the junk cults of celebrity, sensationalism, and gossip are increasingly powerful and wield tremendous economic clout. The cultural conversation devolves and is held hostage to these trends. The corporate wars over who will control the technology of news gathering and electronic communication and data and distribution are increasingly fierce. Taken together, these factors threaten to leave us ignorant of tradition, contemptuous of the habits of quality and excellence, and unable to distinguish among the good, the bad, and the ugly." Well, I don't know the answer to that. That's not building the dream. That's the nightmare side of it. And in a lot of ways, I think it's up to readers. The director, I'm sure, will be quick to point out that our constituency, read much, much more than the general population. And I think I think we came up at one point with a figure of an average of 30 books a year, which is absolutely staggering. When, you know, probably a national average would be something like 1.2, and that would be the Fanny Farmer cookbook. Yeah, exactly. I think it's up to you guys and those who come after us how it all plays out. It's a fluid situation. It's a moving target. It's very exciting. It's fraught with peril, and it's fraught with possibility. So thanks for inviting me.
We do have time for a couple of questions, and if the sound guys could get my mic back up, that'd be easier. Are there any questions?
Marlena?
Who said Marlena? You need to get to a mic.
I'm here.
Oh. Okay.
I'm here at a mic, but I didn't know to press the button. this is Terry Hedgepath from Phoenix, Arizona. My question is, I can tell you why there's so few readers requesting Braille, because I, as a Braille reader, am told by my local library that it costs them $200 a year to subscribe me to Braille, and they would like, you know, requested that I not do that. And so if that's the message I'm receiving, I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Did you have a question, or was that just a comment?
That's just a comment, and okay. I didn't know if he was aware of that. Or
okay, all right, someone's coming to respond.
Kurt Silke. Yes, in Arizona, that's true. They have, your library has contracted, excuse me, with the state of Utah to have Braille services provided, and that is their choice, and what you say is accurate. It's unfortunate. I don't believe that comment necessarily had to be made to you, because it's irrelevant. The fee, which I believe is $200, should cover everything, and they should be encouraging Braille. But again, we can't speak for a local library, but it's a very unfortunate, but the situation you describe is accurate.
Okay.
Have a question.
Yes.
The lady first. You are whom?
This is Kira Larkin from Utah.
Kira?
And I have a question concerning how you choose your books. I don't know if others will agree with me, but sometimes I will get into a series that has, it's a trilogy or a set of five, and I will read the first book and go to look for the second book, and there isn't a second book, but the third one has been produced. or you will have maybe the first and second, but not the final book.
Okay.
And I'm kind of left hanging.
All right.
Yes.
I guess my question is, what makes you do? What makes you choose to produce the first and third book, but not the second book, or book, but not the final book?
This is a persistent problem, and the answer to the question is what's the word? There are many answers. It can be, and I dread even bringing up this possibility. It can be human error. Once in a while,
every now and then,
but clearly not yours, right?
Once in a while, we miss a title we ought to order. It's more likely that a book has been derailed in the production process. It's a long, in an old song, getting back to my folklore stuff, it's a long way to Hazard, it's a long way to Harlan. It's a long way to produce a talking book from a print book, and a lot can go wrong. Frequently, at our quality assurance section, a book may be rejected for technical or aesthetic reasons. The reader may not be up to our standards, or there may be errors in the pronunciation of a name, and it's returned for repair and correction, and that can add months. There's a long queue. In some cases, with our digital conversions from analog to digital books, it's the luck of the draw. These books are not appearing on the digital download site in a systematic order. They're appearing when they're finished. So, in many cases, a narrator that book three out of five, where you've got one, two, four, and five of the series, book three should be along. I would urge anybody who is aware of a missing item in a series to let us know, and I'm going to make the terrible mistake of giving you my email. It's just for only for this purpose. EORE@loc.gov, and I'm easy to find. If you missed that, it's on all kinds of it's on our website and various other places. We do have a policy of maintaining series as coherently as we possibly can, including using the same narrator from one end to the other. Sometimes we can't do that. A narrator retires or moves on to a better place, or not, depending on whether you like the narrator. Things happen, but our aim is to maintain these series coherently. So information we receive from patrons is useful.
All right. And our final question is the gentleman who was first at the mic.
Yes, I am. Right here. This is Bob Hatcher of Massachusetts.
And Bob, before you ask your question, let me just say that this will be the final question, but I'm sure that you all can catch up with these good folks at the Lua meeting. So go ahead, Bob.
This is one I've seen come up on the digital test site list. Is there any way that you guys could provide guidance to APH so that we could get magazines like Newsweek and Reader's Digest on digital talking book?
Kurt Silke. APH, of course, is a separate organization, and I can't speak for Tuck Tinsley and the group. But I do know that they produced their magazines for public relations purposes and for fundraising purposes, and we would be delighted to involve them. But there's a certain amount to be said that when the magazine is issued from the organization itself. So I just say that it's their choice, and we are always willing to cooperate. But I think you might better address your question to Tuck. I know that he's here, and I know that he'll be speaking at your banquet on Friday evening, and so you might catch up with him sometime between now and Friday and tell him I sent you, and he'd love that.
All right. Let's give these gentlemen a wonderful round of applause and show them how much we appreciate what they do for our library. Thank you, Kurt. Thank you, Ed. It's been a pleasure to have you here. All right, we are going to get ready to do door prizes. So we need door prize Debbie and Susie Surprise to get ready. But, before we do that, our esteemed president has an announcement.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Who seats the floor?
Sue Amateur.
Sue?
I just would like to make a brief announcement. Is that appropriate now?
No. Okay. We will do announcements just before the break.
I'll wait.
All right. Did someone else seek the floor?
Yes, Brenda Dillon.
Yes, Brenda.
Whenever it best fits your agenda, I would like to announce the silver sponsors.
All right. We will do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Marlena, how about if we do, Brenda, we'll do the silver sponsors right after the break.
Yep, that's good.
And Carla, are you here?
I am.
All right. Carla's got some announcements. And I'm going to let Carla do her announcements first because they might be some of the announcements I was going to make. So after Carla, and I'll make a couple of announcements, and then we'll do door prizes. Go ahead, Carla.
Okay. I have an announcement from registration. There are several of you that ordered T-shirts on your pre-registration, and you have not picked up the T-shirts. If you are one of those individuals who ordered a T-shirt on pre-registration, not a person who wants to purchase a T-shirt now, just those who have already paid for them on pre-registration, you have not picked them up, please go to registration by 1 o'clock today to get your T-shirt. They do have a list of names, but they need to see you there in person in order to share the shirt with you. Also, we have the Maryland and Massachusetts Caucus, the M&M Caucus, they said, tomorrow, Thursday, at 12:30 in the Morrow. That can't be. Scrap that. they're going to be eating lunch with somebody else. Okay, scrap that, people. I'll have a change when I come back. All right, and then also ACBHSP is having their pizza and networking tonight at 5 p.m., and it is in room 1146, which is the executive director's suite. And that's all I have for right now. I'll fix that room assignment and be back.
All right. Let me make a couple of announcements, and then Sue, well, Darian first, because Darian wanted to make some announcements previously, and then Sue. But well, here's what I've got. The two focus groups on accessible currency, you need to go to booth 72 to sign up, I believe, and those will be, you need to know the times in case you have other plans, are at 2 p.m. and 3:30 p.m. I will not give you the room because you can't just show up. They're only taking a limited number. So those two focus groups are at 2 p.m. and 3:30 p.m. You need to go to booth 72. Also, Dina Wilson is available now. She is across from the registration desk. She was not there at 7:30 this morning. Somebody was looking for her at 7:30. The poor lady needs to have some breakfast. So she is available now and probably most of the time during the sessions and early and in the afternoons. Also, a reminder, the speaker's reception. We need the speakers there, and we need people to come to and ask questions. Hopefully, Kurt and Dr. O'Reilly will be there as well. 6 p.m. in Stanley. 6 p.m. in Stanley. Darian, quickly, mm-hmm.
Mitch,
if you're at a mic.
Thank you, Mitch. This is Darian. Carla made my announcement.
Very good. Ms. Amateur.
Thank you. Tomorrow afternoon in the Walnut Room, which is in the West Tower at 3:30 p.m., there will be a discussion group for women only. It is for women who have survived and or been diagnosed with breast cancer. We want to discuss the social, economic, and emotional aspects of the disease and to begin to develop a strategy for being able to provide current medical information in alternate format for women with breast cancer. I'm encouraging those of you to come. If you have questions, you can contact me in 867. Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Sue.
Mr. President.
David Trott.
David Trott has an announcement I know about the store. Go ahead, David.
Mr. President and ladies and gentlemen, we, as you know, in order to raise money for the Braille Forum, you have to raise the money first to pay the prizes. I am proud to announce to you that we are now officially raising money for the Forum. So let's get together and buy those tickets and so we can make a significant contribution this year and maybe even work to enhance the pages. Please see Billie Jean, Rhonda Trott over at the ACB store, Lane Waters at the registration desk, Mike Godino or Burl Colley or myself. Thank you. And remember, let's make a significant contribution this year. Even if you have to join before partners, let's buy those tickets.
I got mine. All right.
Mr. President.
There was a lady first.
Yeah, Mr. President.
Yes.
This is Carla. I have the room. The Massachusetts and Maryland caucus can be in the Nunn Room tomorrow at 12:30.
All right. Last announcement from the gentleman. Yes, saw the mic.
Yeah, Mr. President, this is Alan Peterson from North Dakota Association of the Blind. I'm announcing the gathering of the Midwest Caucus at 5 o'clock in the Sampson Room. It used to be called the Small Fry Caucus. Anyone who is not part of a caucus is welcome to come. It's not only in this way, Midwest states, but anyone who is not a part of a caucus. So welcome to anyone who wants to be a part of our group and gather.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Alan. Two door prizes, quickly.
Okay, we have a Kentucky gift basket.
The winner is Margaret Johnson of Arizona.
Johnson, are you here?
Arkansas.
Well, good. I'm not the only one who can't tell Arizona and Arkansas apart. Margaret Johnson from Arkansas, you here?
Doesn't sound like it.
Karen?
Oh, she's here.
She is here. Make yourself known.
An audio tape and $25 from New Mexico chapter.
Is that a mystery tape? What's on it?
The Call of the Wild.
Ah, all right. Jack London. It's actually a piece of literature I read.
The winner is Don Sanders from Clearwater, Florida.
Don Sanders, Clearwater, Florida is here.
Okay.
Marlena has a quick announcement.
Yeah, just real quickly, please remember to go by booth 13 in the exhibit hall to visit Tenacity and make your phone call regarding HR 6320. It's an easy way to get me off your back, and I'll stop asking you to contact your congressman. So please go by and do that. And I need to see Eric Bridges and Mark Reichert up here at the break. Thanks.
We stand in recess until 10:50.
There we go. That's it for this session. Interesting one on talking books and things. And we carry on with that at the beginning of the next session with Mitzi Friedlander, who is a talking book narrator, and that should indeed be interesting. Now, during the break, we've another one of our GDUI podcasts, this time on Puppy Starter.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Sound advice.
When you think about the most wonderful jobs in the entire world, tops on the list, or at least in the top 10, would have to be spending your day with puppies and then getting the opportunity to deliver puppies to people who are waiting for the opportunity to raise that puppy. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and welcome to the Guide Dog Podcast, where today I'm speaking with Mick Aguilera, affectionately known as the Puppy Stork. More specifically, his title is Program Coordinator for the Puppy Raising Program at Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California. Welcome, Mick.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
How did you end up with such a wonderful job?
Well, you know, I ended up applying at Guide Dogs for the Blind 12 years ago. I was accepted into the kennel department. I was on the front lines for 2 years working with our breeder dogs, pulling out puppies in the middle of the night as they were being born. And within 2 years, I really needed to use more of my people skills, so I applied for the puppy raising program and was hired as one of the many program coordinators. And with that job, I also work as the puppy stork, which I'm known as, delivering puppies to 8 Western states with one of the 2 puppy trucks we have here on campus.
And you're delivering the puppies to people who will raise them for some period of time?
Right. We have puppy raisers in 8 Western states, and we'll go as far as Colorado, Utah, Idaho. And those puppy raisers get their little puppies, like this is little Bonnie here, who's probably about 7 weeks old. We deliver them when they're 8 weeks old. And then we come back to pick up those puppies. Like, we'll be picking up Bonnie when she's about a year, year and a half, and when she needs to return to our campus to start her official guide dog training.
So who are the people that raise the puppies for that period of time? And how do they say goodbye?
Well, people ask that all the time. And I always tell people 2 of the most important tools on the puppy truck are Kleenex, because we cry right along with the raisers who are giving their dogs back, and of course poop bags, because we're also having to clean up after them. It's like your kid going to college. I would send you your recall letter saying that it's time for Bonnie to come back to campus with a specific date and time and place. And when Bonnie returns to campus, it's like she's going to college, because they'll get a report card every Thursday. And these raisers, some have raised 20 or more puppies in their lifetime. We have youth, adult raisers, 4-H members, non-4-H members. So for them, they realize that not only is their dog just coming back for guide dog training, but they have the possibility of meeting that blind or visually impaired person where Bonnie will be working with for her life.
So they say goodbye for good, even though they get to keep updated on their puppy's progress.
Well, they say goodbye for good only until Bonnie, say, would graduate. Then they get invited to present their dog to the graduate on stage, whether it's here in San Rafael or in our campus up in Boring, Oregon.
And then if, for instance, Bonnie ends up being a career change dog, do they have the opportunity to adopt her back?
Yes, they have the option of keeping her as a pet. If they can't keep her as a pet, we have a large career change department, and people could actually apply online for a career change dog. But a lot of times our career change dogs go on for other careers, dogs for diabetics, search and rescue, therapy dogs.
And these are volunteer positions, raising puppies.
Oh, yes. All our puppy raisers are volunteers. They work with a club leader within their county of their state where they live, and they have regular meetings that they need to be committed to going to. There's a puppy raising manual. And then, of course, they have special events. We have a huge fun day celebration. It's like a big carnival in appreciation for our raisers once a year. It's always in August, in the summertime. And Bonnie's getting
speaks.
A little...
Bonnie, she had been so quiet for so long, no one even knew she was there.
So as a volunteer, yes, we are here in San Rafael supporting them with vet forms, with materials, with supplies. They do get a packet of supplies with the dog food to get them started, as well as ear supplies, toothbrush and paste for the dogs as well.
Now, do they eat particular kinds of food?
Right now they are eating the Hills. It's the puppy large breed formula foods. And they're eating 1 cup 3 times a day. And then they get advanced to the adult formula as they start growing.
And this is because someone has deemed this to be the best possible food to feed them?
Right. Well, with our program, we do look for the most ideal foods for the puppies in the program. And so, yes, they are given a small bag to start off with. And then within each club, a lot of clubs have fundraisers to buy food for their puppy's lifetime for that year, year and a half as well.
Now, they're not in official training during that year, year and a half, and yet there's much that you can do to properly socialize a puppy during those early months. Tell us a little bit about what you recommend or how puppy raisers are trained, in effect, to really give their puppies the best start in life.
Well, what the puppy raisers do is they do work with their club leader in their county. The club leader, they have meetings 2-3 times a month, and it's socializing the puppies. Some raisers take their puppies to work every day, to school every day. A lot of high school students, their puppy is literally graduated with them through high school for a particular year of their high school life. And so that socializing, you know, there's a lot of rules and regulations, how they're fed. They can only eat out of a bowl. There's only particular toys they can play with. They don't want them to become distracted by rolling, like, balls, like tennis balls and things. So there are very specific rules and regulations for puppy raisers.
And those rules are applicable only to people raising puppies who are going to be guide dogs, right? Because rolling balls would be fine if you were raising any other sort of puppy.
Exactly. For a regular puppy that's just your pet, you know, you, like, I have a career change golden retriever, and she loves the tennis balls. She can get away with murder right now, but boy, as a puppy in a puppy raising home, she had very specific toys and rules that she had to follow. But no, for puppy raisers in our program, they do have those rules that they have to follow throughout that year.
What do you look for in selecting puppy raisers?
The commitment to attend the meetings. Just a lot of our puppy raisers are public speakers. They're out there in the community talking about guide dogs because as a nonprofit, we're always doing fundraisers. We're always encouraging our raisers to actually be out there working with other organizations. It's just a big PR opportunity for all our raisers. And a lot of our puppy raisers, especially as youth and high school students, it really helps them in their future careers as public speaking and gives them real confidence in what they're doing and in their lives and with dogs. Of course, they love dogs as well.
You have to love dogs.
Oh,
that's the first
yes.
priority. And if you're a young person or a high school student, I would think your family needs to approve of
exactly.
this. Because having a puppy, for those of us who've raised puppies, is a really big job. It's a lot of responsibility.
It really is. And, you know, and we always, you know, we look for puppy raisers year-round in the eight western states. And a lot of people say, well, can you have cats or other animals? And, well, yes, you really can, because part of Bonnie's socialization now here in our kennel is we have a staff cat, George. And George is in our puppy kennel working with these puppies every morning so that way Bonnie doesn't have an obsession of chasing cats. Because as a guide dog, Bonnie needs to be able to not be distracted by cats or hamsters or other dogs or rolling leaves or buses or taxi cabs, things like that.
So other dogs are okay too?
Oh, other dogs are great. Oh, yeah, because most guide dog users do have other dogs and animals and pets.
I'm assuming they have to be on leash at all times?
Yes, the guide dog puppies, there are a lot of rules as far as being on leash. They don't want them to go to dog parks, say, where there's a lot of animals that they don't know about. But they do a lot of socializing within their club with other guide dog puppies as well.
And what are the eight western states?
Oh, we have our campus up in Oregon. So we work with Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Colorado. We work with Utah, Arizona, Nevada, and, of course, California. We have a lot of raisers. And I think that...
I wasn't counting.
I wasn't either.
I don't know. If you need one more, it's probably New Mexico, but maybe
no,
you don't.
No, we don't go that far.
Okay. So you drive a puppy truck, and you deliver puppies
right.
to raisers. Any great stories of times where you've delivered a puppy and it was particularly touching?
I'm afraid
touching?
We need to cut this because we need to go back to the convention itself and Marlena.
Dylan, with our list of, is it silver, Brenda?
Yes.
Silver sponsors. Go ahead, Brenda.
All right. These are the folks who contributed $50 each to support the ACB convention. Albert Anderson, Bonnie Balmer, Artis Bazin, Ann Brash, Melanie Brunson, Carolyn Burley, Karen Campbell, Ray Campbell, Brian Charlson, Kim Charlson, Frank Cuda, Jay Doudna, Steve Dresser, Grady Ebert, Paul Edwards, Shell Hart, Barbara Hayes, Skip Hayes, Charlotte Himmel, George Holliday, John Horst, Alice Jackson, Tom Jones, Susan Kearney, Marilyn Lutter, Mike Mandel, Anna Olson, James Pico, Hope Petrolungo, James Poppy, Sarah Presley, Lynn Roberts, Shirley Roberts, Joyce Rogers, Richard Ruida, Stuart Russell, Leroy Saunders, Patricia Saunders, MJ Schmidt, Deanna Scoggins.
Yes,
Donna Seliger. Donna Smith. Naomi Sewell. Kathleen Spear. Leslie Tom. Janice Thomas. Lawrence Turnbull. Jim Tyrell. Pauline Ulry. Ann Weatherby. Faye Williams and Renee Zellickson. Let's give a big round of appreciative applause. And Marlena?
Yes.
May I add a reminder about the auction? A few of you still have auction items you need to turn in. We will be over in the Poplar Room and also in the Archibald Ballroom getting set up this afternoon. So if you miss us otherwise, try to get your items there. You will be able to get your bidding numbers beginning at 6 o'clock, and that's also when the preview hour begins. We look forward to having you there. It's going to be a great time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Brenda.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is Robert Miller from Florida.
Yes, Robert.
From the wet state of Florida, from
yes.
what I hear. We would like to donate $1,000 to the Public Relations Handbook.
Whoa.
Unfortunately, the check is a casualty of a quiet car, but it will be forthcoming to the national office.
Okay, let's give Florida a round of applause, and we'll get Robert to tell us about the quiet car casualty at another time. Thank you so much, Florida.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Marlena, this is Jay Bader from Florida.
Yes?
One thing I wanted to add from what Brenda said, at least it was in the today's...
Quickly, Jay.
It was in today's Post-Dispatch. Charlie Hodge was also listed as a silver sponsor.
I'm sorry, what?
Charlie Hodge was also listed as a silver sponsor, at least in the print version.
Okay, all right.
Did you not
Thank
give
you.
$100? Charlie, did you not give $100? Did you not give $100?
All right. Is everything all right, Brenda?
I know. All I know is what's printed. I believe we read his name yesterday, perhaps on the wrong list. But, Charlie, we thank you for whatever donation.
That's
and I just
right.
want to say, as I was reading this, a gentleman came up to me and said, I didn't know that we could do this. So Paul Vayu from Texas just gave us another $100 for a gold sponsor. Thank you.
Great. All right. Thank you so much to all of the sponsors who have donated at whatever level you donate. It's certainly appreciated by ACB. Do we have door prize Debbie and Susie Surprise available? On the way.
Marlena.
Who seeks the floor?
Carol Ewing from Nevada.
Carol.
We'd like to say thank you to the New Mexico chapter who just donated $250.
Order, please. May we have order. Go ahead, Carol.
The New Mexico chapter just donated $250 to the Durwood K. McDaniel First Timers Fund. And we'd like to say thank you.
Thank you, New Mexico.
And we also have plenty of tickets. I'm in the Nevada chapter. The seating area. My room number is 806. So if you need tickets for this $300, $150, or $75 drawing on Friday night, we have them. Thank you.
All right. And Carol, to whom do those tickets get turned in?
To myself or to the office. Or wherever.
All righty.
We will draw at the banquet on Friday night.
Perfect.
So we have a few days.
All right. Thank you. All right. Are our door prize queens ready?
We are.
All right. Let's hear the first door prize.
We have an audiobook. I believe it's Winner's Heart. And $50 from Alaska Independent Blind.
And the winner?
Christine Jayun from UCAP. From California, Christine.
Is Christine here? Christine Jayun?
Yes. Yakaipa, California.
Okay.
She's okay. Draw another name.
Marlena Lieber.
Oh. Oh, my gosh. I don't think she's here.
She's up front.
Oh, my word. Okay. Golly. How come that couldn't happen when there's money or food? You know, it's a... Oh, that's right. Oh, I didn't hear the $50. Oh. All right. And one more door prize, please.
Okay. Another audio book, The Hunt for Red October,
ooh,
and $25 from the Mountain State.
Ah.
Charles Burt Boyer, Louisville, Kentucky. Burt?
Burt Boyer.
Burt Boyer, Louisville?
Thank you.
Okay.
Is he here? All right, draw another name.
Okay. Kelly James, Jacksonville, Florida.
Is Kelly here? All right, Kelly is here. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so excited to bring on our next speaker.
She's not here, I'm hearing.
Oh, she's... Yes, she's here. She's right behind me. I am so excited to bring on our next speaker. This is someone whose voice has carried me, and I know all of you, through many happy days of our lives and maybe some more trying days of our lives. But always when we read a book and she's the narrator, somehow it just kind of makes you feel better. So for an encore performance, I give you your friend, my friend, Mitzi Friedlander. Let's give her a huge round of applause.
Funny to not be able to do the microphone correctly. I changed purses, and doggone, I forgot to bring a handkerchief. But what I did, I stopped in the ladies' room on the way in, and I got two Kleenexes, so I'm okay. But I better blow my nose. Okay. It's wonderful to be here, and I want to give best love again and thanks to Adam and Carla Rushable for asking me to speak here. And to my new and longtime friends and in my hometown and in a hotel that is very famous. Now, this is your history lesson. This Gold House Hotel is named for the first Gold House, which was close to the actual riverfront site of the original Gold House, which catered to the hoi polloi in the steamboat days. But the river couldn't be pumped in to save it from a fiery end in January 1865. The local newspaper called the old Gold House one of the most magnificent in the country. A newer and more luxurious Gold House rose at 1st and Main. We're now at about 4th and Main in 1869. So this is your history lesson, but you don't have to take a test. Grand Duke Alexis of Russia and Charles Dickens stayed there. In 1968, with the River Renaissance here in Louisville, the new Gold House was built, and that's where we meet today. But enough of architectural history. I am here to confess to my history of addiction. My name is Mitzi, and I am addicted to narrating talking books. Thank you. I am powerless over this addiction, so I turned it over to my higher power, and through years of prayer and meditation have come to believe that my higher power approves. So this is my 12-step program. But to tell the whole story, I need to step back, way back, to step one, like 45 years ago. And it was a giant step to early in the 1960s. Do you remember Dale Carter Cooper? And I were rehearsing a play. She said to me, this is Dale, Mitzi, darling, I would ask you to, why don't you audition for Talking Books at the American Printing House for the Blind? And I did. And NLS agreed. I auditioned. NLS agreed, as did Tynalu Wallace, our Talking Book director at APH. My first book was a wonderful nature novel for young people. It really was good. It was Summer of the Falcon by Jean Craighead George. And I did the best I could, but that was the time when the Ford Falcon was built. And I was too dumb to look it up in the dictionary, and I said, Summer of the Falcon. So it was sent back, and I had to do almost the whole book over again. But it was approved, and through highly punctuated and by mispronunciations, misreads, and mispronunciation mostly, I progressed to step three, and that was variety. More books of all sorts, cookbooks, great juveniles, self-help books, the Vietnam Wall magazines, hysterical novels, World Book Encyclopedia, Rosemary Watercress novels. You can ask about what I mean by these. Bodice rippers, you don't need to ask. Serious nonfiction with many footnotes and captions, poetry, many mystery series, some westerns and down easterns, and lots of southern y'all. And some so weird they defy description. Step four, you know that, I'll bet. Step four, while the titles narrated increased, so did the years. When I started at APH, our daughter Fidel, who, by the way, has a program that if you turn on FM this evening from 8 to 9, she'll be introducing, I think, a great program on WUOL, part of Public Radio Partnership in Louisville, The Art of Great Singing. So you hear Fidel. Fidel was 7 then, Eric 2, and Bill didn't cook yet. And same time I was performing in operas for Kentucky Opera Association, U of L Playhouse, Actors Theater Louisville. I was Jeannie with the light brown hair in the Stephen Foster story, Annie and Annie Get Your Gun, Mame and Mame, Mama Rose and Gypsy, Mrs. Anna in The King and I, and as soloist in church choirs. Hither and yon. And by the 1990s, Bill had become an excellent cook. Along with his busy professional life, I remember that I used to leave a note if I had a rehearsal or something like that. Dear Bill, turn on oven like 350 degrees. 15 minutes later, put casserole in oven. Now he's just great. That was long ago. Step five. At a Greensboro, North Carolina. Oh, that was a mouth noise, you all. I'm sorry. Greensboro, North Carolina, at an ACB conference in the 90s. Kurt Silke is Kurt. I think Kurt's supposed to be here today. Ah, he was okay. But this is the truth. I'm not telling anything. announced to my astonishment that I narrated some 800 titles and made some reference that I might get to 1,000. So I began to hope the 1,000th would come up before my curtain went down. Step six, Jack Decker, who's our production chief at APH, and Ray Randles, who was then our supervisor, were counting two. Beyond the double night, James Morrison Hedy had been brailled at APH. Hedy was blind and deaf, a poet, a philosopher, and inspirer of the Kentucky School for the Blind and APH. He was born and lived near Louisville, as does the author, Ken Thompson. Jack managed to get the book sent to APH for recording, step seven, by me, as the 1,000th title. Thank you. Step eight. But I didn't know this, as I was to be summoned into Ray Randall's office, not knowing what I would hear. But I heard that I was about to be the first person to record. See, there, my children said, there she goes again. The 1,000th title in the whole NLS program. Yay! So, thank you. Step eight. But the surprise was theirs, since the book's author, Ken Thompson, and his family were and are longtime friends of ours. Was that fate or coincidence? I prefer providence. Step nine, the celebration parties given by APH, I identified them as the in-house and out-house parties. In-house on the APH lawn for all employees was wonderful. And also by Tuck, Gary Mudd, Jack Decker, Roberta Williams, all these people were in on that, and of course Ray Randles, and of course many more. The outhouse party was for many personal friends and others interested in the NLS program. Step 10, just a few more steps now. And I shared it for many years with one of my favorite human beings, with Roy Avers. We shared the studio, which was wonderful. He was there from 8 o'clock to 12:30, and then I from 1 o'clock to 5:30, which is what I do now. Roy has moved now, but originally I do want to tell you about this studio, because George Patterson, I don't know if any of you have been around long enough to remember George. He was a producer at WAVE and WAVE-TV. When he went into a wheelchair, I think this is very thoughtful, and this was years ago, a ramp was built in our studio so he could be wheeled down the ramp and into the studio and record. So George could navigate this. For some years after his death, the ramp remained. Then it was removed. Then Roy moved to a different studio. So I'm left to my own devices with steps, with my right knee, what it's like, into the foreseeable future. Step 11, so I can continue to express my deep gratitude for being able to do what I love to do most, get paid for it, and to believe that I somehow have touched other lives. So let's go on to step 12. Hi, and hearty greetings from all the APH narrators you know and enjoy, and many you will get to know better. Andy Pyle, who is just on his second book, I've known since before he was born. So kind of look for Andy. He's grand. And a last piece, and this is the step 12, a last piece from the book of Isaiah, if I may read it, that reflects my joy in my work and in my other work, which I'm quite involved with, Interfaith Paths to Peace, which has originated in Louisville, and we're very proud of that. Here's from Isaiah. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of Yahweh's glory." The pivots on the threshold shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am one of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the Holy One, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mitzi. Let's give her a big ACB round of applause. Come on, you guys.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have time for some questions? You need to get to a mic. I heard a yes on my left. You need to be at a mic. You need to be at a mic. The question is, will you be at the speaker's reception this evening?
I didn't know there was a speaker's reception, but I'd love to miss the outreach committee at Christ Church.
All right.
I
have a question.
All right. And you are whom?
Kathy Farina from New York.
All right. First Kathy and then the gentleman. Go ahead, Kathy.
What was your absolute favorite book to record, or is there one?
There is, and I've answered the same title many times, and that is Charlotte's Web.
Hello.
All right, the gentleman, you're recognized.
I have a question. My name is Danny Crone. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. Mitzi Friedlander, I wonder if it was you who, on the introductory record of my first talking book player in the 70s, read a passage that went something like this, that someone got, a man and woman got in an argument, and he said, "Since you don't know anything about politics, you better keep silent." And she said, "I'm not talking about politics, I'm talking about manners."
Oh, that sounds wonderful. No, I do. I may, well, now look, it's getting to be 1,500 books.
OK.
Okay, do we have another question for
Missy? That's wonderful. That's a wonderful phrase.
Yes. My name is Dwayne Hodges. I'm from Arkansas, and you just answered my question. I'm very impressed.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks very much.
And we can take a couple of more.
I think somebody's coming up to the microphone. Right now I'm reading a, narrating a bodice ripper. A bodice ripper.
Marlena.
And I don't even need to explain that now, do I?
Marlena.
All right, the gentleman at the mic.
This is Jay Doudna from Oklahoma City.
Okay, thanks.
Mitzi, I want to say how much I've enjoyed your reading over the years, and the thing that I like most about when you read, it's pretty easy to get into the book right away, and we're hearing pictures. We're seeing pictures.
Thank you. See, that's what I see. Yeah. That's exactly what I see. We're seeing pictures
before we know it, and we're lost, and people talk to us, and we say, not now, I'm listening to a book. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And the lady at the mic.
Is this my turn?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Joyce Rogers from Cincinnati. Mitzi, I just remember when we had our state convention in 1998, and we had such a very, very special narrator to speak at our convention, and I got a chance to introduce that very special lady with the 12-step program now, Mitzi Freelander.
Yeah,
I just can't tell you how much we appreciate it. You're coming there,
and how
much we appreciate everything you've done as far as being a narrator for NLS. You're a wonderful lady.
It's the joy of my life.
Thank you. Marlena,
yes, this will be the last question. Yeah.
Yes, this is Evelyn Larson from Brooklyn, New York. I want you to know, Mitzi Freelander, that I spent at least three nights of this convention, after the sessions were over, curled up in bed, reading a book, Sailing for Murder, which you read. And I could hardly wait to get to the end of it, and I couldn't guess the murder.
Okay, and the title again?
Pardon?
The title of the book?
I think it was Sailing for Murder or something like that. I'd have to go.
I wouldn't doubt that, because I do 11 series. I do 11 series. And lucky enough to know personally Sue Grafton, since she was a little girl. She came from Louisville, Kentucky, and my brother and her dad, my older brother, and her dad were in the same law firm. So I've known her for many, many years, and she's a grand human being.
Well, as we declared at the APH reception the other night, I don't think anyone in this room who's read this series will disagree. Mm-hmm. Mitzi Freelander is Kinsey Millhone.
Yeah!
Thank you, Mitzi.
And thanks very, very much.
The speaker's reception is at 6 o'clock in the Stanley Room, and we hope that you will be there at 6 o'clock in the Stanley Room. Thank you very much, Mitzi. Let's give her another big round of applause.
Mitzi, thank you for entertaining me through my dissertation.
Okay. All right. Oh, now I have to get the mic. There we go. Okay. Well, we have something a little different coming up now. The program item that you will see on your program dealing with the digital TV converter box program isn't going to happen. Yeah, however, the Marlena Donahue show is going to happen. And there's a chair to my left and a chair to my right. Guests, yes, yes. Go around me there. Yeah. Now, we are literally doing this, folks, on the fly. And my good friends, Eric Bridges and Mark Reichert, let's give them a round of applause while they're getting settled. And there's mics in those two places. Okay? Eric, where are you? Okay. All right. They have agreed to...
To be victims,
yes, to appear on the Marlena Donahue show to talk about important legislation affecting those of us who are blind. So in the true Donahue style, hi, welcome to the Donahue Show. Eric Bridges, would you tell us just a little bit about yourself in one sentence, please?
Sure, Marlena. I'm
Phil to you.
I'm 5 foot nine. And I'm the Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs for ACB.
And Mark Reichert, you hail from and do what?
I don't hail from anything.
From Arlington, Virginia, the Director of Public Policy of American Foundation for the Blind. It's great to be here.
Now, I understand that there is something out there that has got the community in a buzz called H.R. 6320. Mr. Reichert, you may start by perhaps giving us a thumbnail of why is this important to blind people?
It's important because right now we don't have the kind of access to cell phones, to PDAs, to Blackberries, to exactly the same kind of technology that everybody else is using every day in school and work and community, and it's about time that blind people have access to those technologies.
But why do
blind... And it's also very important, Phil, Marlena, whatever you're calling yourself these days, that blind people finally once again have the kind of access to video description that they absolutely deserve. And we're going to do something about the fact that the Court of Appeals threw out the video description rules that were put in place and build that back in and make sure that the televisions we use, the DVRs, the equipment that we use to actually get to those television programs can actually be used for a change.
So you're telling me that blind people watch television?
Astonishing.
I don't know how to answer that.
Mr. Bridges, what would you like to add here, sir?
They certainly don't feel television, for God's sake.
Mr. Reichert, be quiet. Your turn is not yet.
I'm sorry. I won't do it again.
Mr. Bridges, ignore him. I'd like your comment, please.
I guess I'm the straight man in this trio of revelry.
So to speak.
All right.
No elaborating, just comment.
The other thing that is important to add to this is the inaccessibility of emergency information.
Hear, hear.
To people who are blind through broadcast TV. I'm sure all of you are aware, you're sitting there, you're watching TV, and then all of a sudden you hear the beep, the tone, and then it's time to stick your hand out the window, turn on a radio, flip to another channel to see what's happening, to see what the problem is. Is it due to weather? Is it an Amber Alert? What is it? The blindness community in this country has been obviously extraordinarily frustrated by this. The FCC has failed to act. This bill would call on the FCC to establish methods whereby that information can be audibly announced. That is something that is imperative to the safety and well-being of the blind and visually impaired community.
Hear, hear.
All right. All right. We will be back in a moment. We have a word from our sponsor. Go to Tenacity Booth 13, write to your congressman, but you can call them from right here at Tenacity Booth 13. And we're back.
Oh, dear. I think she's on the Marlena Show. No. I don't know.
Oh, this is crazy. Okay, so...
We're going to write into the legislation that Marlena will read all the emergency
announcements. There you go, there you go. An earthquake is coming.
Get out of the way!
All right, it's not called Marlena. Mr. Reichert, in what other ways can people who are blind then begin to become involved and advocate?
Well, you've just made an announcement, which I think is excellent.
No, that was my sponsor. I'm Phil.
You've just shilled for someone who paid for some advertising space. And I think we ought to recognize that it's a very, very valuable thing that Tenacity is doing. And I think that that is one way that folks can be involved. Get a hold of your member of Congress. Let them know on both the House and Senate side that blind people absolutely not only want but need access to the kinds of modern technologies that everybody else is using that are so important to keep a job, to be able to get educated on terms of equality with their peers and to be actively involved in the community. It's very, very important. This year we've got a bill, H.R. 6320. Don't know if it's going to happen today, maybe tomorrow, sometime soon you're going to hear a resolution about it. You know, pay some attention to that. You can talk with Eric. Eric is your champion for ACB. He does an excellent job. Work with him. And when he sends you announcements or you get announcements from yours truly, other people in the field that say, hey, this bill's moving, or get a hold of somebody and let them know that we need a sponsor for this legislation. Blind people need it. Please, please, please respond. Every time we get up here, Eric and I, and talk about being involved, a lot of people say, oh, you know, God's sakes, you guys always talk about that stuff all the time. Does it really make a difference? The answer is, without any drop of cynicism, it absolutely makes all the difference in the world, one person's comment. It's how we've got the textbook legislation. It's how we've had increases in NLS funding. You just go right down the line. It's not been because of any of the stuff necessarily that Eric and I do. It's because of what we are enabled, what we enable you all individually to do. So please, call, be involved. Eric?
And a question for Mr. Bridges. I understand, sir, that there was quite a hearing on May the 1st on Capitol Hill. Would you talk to our viewers about that, please?
Sure. On May 1st, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, their subcommittee on telecommunications and the Internet, held a hearing to discuss this very bill, which was then only a draft piece of legislation. The purpose of the hearing was to hear from people with disabilities regarding the challenges that they currently have in accessing all of the devices that Mark just spoke with you about, PDAs, DVRs, TVs, DVD players, all of that. And along with that, there were a couple of members of industry that testified as well. I am very proud that Sergeant Major Jesse Acosta was able to come out to Washington and testify on ACB's behalf. He was unquestionably the star of the show and had members of Congress lined up 10 deep at the end to take a picture and chat with him. And that hearing, and I would argue his performance, were very key in having this piece of legislation introduced. It went from a theoretical sense of, okay, here's a bunch of things down on paper, to an actual bill that we have been actively negotiating with industry partners concerning certain provisions. So the folks that we're working with are companies such as AT&T, Verizon, and U.S. Telecom. They have actually reached out to us to work on the different provisions within this bill. And it's obviously an ongoing situation.
Thank you. Thank you. We will be right back to take audience questions.
Uh-oh.
But first, a word from our sponsor. Hi, guys.
Whoa.
Do you want to make a difference in how you find accessible user interfaces? Are you tired of turning on those cool DVDs and not figuring out how to make it go? When you hear those oh-so-pregnant pauses, do you wonder what are they doing?
Yes, I do.
If you do, go on down to my friends at Tenacity. They're on booth 13, and they're going to let you make a call for free. Not to me, unfortunately. I charge.
That
but
costs
they're going to make
a
call. They're going to let you call your congressman. So go on down to Tenacity, booth 13.
All right, we are back. We are back with audience questions and the remaining portion.
I don't know if
portion.
I should move closer or farther away. I'm not sure.
Of the Donahue show.
You know, I think that I tuned into the wrong channel. I thought I was watching Phil Donahue, but it seems to be Oprah.
Honey, Oprah would never do that. Let me tell you.
It's about to be Jerry Springer
Do we have any questions?
Question.
I'm Marlena Springer, yes.
Question. This
yes,
is Joe Sorensen in New Mexico. Now, audio description, the great thing, and I don't know if it'll be the same way when it's compared to digital on February 17th, but on CBS, NBC, and ABC, audio description was just restricted to the top 25 markets. Now, this was not true of public television all over, no matter what size of the market, there is audio description, and this also includes the cable channels such as Lifetime. Back in Minnesota, a member and I worked hard to get Lifetime back on audio description. But anyway, the question is, when we are converged over to digital, the audio description, if some way the CBS, NBC, and ABC would not be restricted just to the top 25 markets. And thank you for your great show. And look forward to be, we love you, we look forward to, I look forward to be on the microphone soon, so
all right.
Thank you.
It's time for you to get off the microphone now so that Mr. Reichert can answer.
You're absolutely correct. When the regs were first in place, it was limited to 4 hours per week during prime time, limited top 25 markets. We're going to start by simply saying the court was absolutely wrongheaded in throwing that out. We're going to put that back in, make sure that it applies absolutely to analog and digital. And then we're going to do something that will absolutely ensure that we don't have to go through this nonsense and have to deal with an unholy alliance between some of the industry folks and, frankly, some of the, well, you know, in our field, who didn't want to have video description involved. We're going to make sure that the FCC has not only the clear authority to regulate, but is absolutely mandated to regulate additional description. That's what we're going to do.
Marlena.
I have a question.
Marlena.
The person who said Marlena, and then the person who said, I have a question.
Karen Campbell from Illinois, and I hope this microphone is working.
It's fine.
Okay. There is another provision in this bill, and I know you have commented on it, Marlena. In this, one of the provisions of this bill, and this community needs this provision, there is a provision for up to $10 million a year from the Universal Service Fund to purchase telecommunications equipment for people who are deafblind. This community needs this provision. This is an underserved community. Please get involved.
Thank you, Karen. And the I have a question lady.
Yes, this is Kira Larkin from Utah. I have a question about, you mentioned getting it so that if there's announcements about the weather or Amber Alerts, what about shows or commercials where they say, call the number on your screen? And you say, oh, I'd love to get that product, or I'd love to call in and give my comment, but you can't because, well, you can't see the number on the screen.
Eric, Mr. Bridges will respond.
This is intended to cover emergency information on broadcast TV. I completely empathize with you. And in fact, we had been working with the National Association of Broadcasters on a couple of their digital TV transition commercials where they said, you know, the name of the website, and then said, or call the number on your screen. It is a huge frustration, but what we're looking at here is access to emergency information.
All right, we have time
Madam
for...
Speaker, hello, Marlena.
Hello, Josephine Feeney from New York City.
Josephine, I recognize you.
Thank you. I hope I'm not in the minority here, however, and it's great what we're trying to do with accessibility and DVDs. However, I am a movie theater goer.
And I think that it's becoming increasingly difficult to go to the movies these days because so much of it is animated or is visual or is spoofy. And some of the theaters are beginning to have special technology so that you can wear an earpiece and have the movies described, but it's very few, and you have to go at a certain time and blah, blah, blah. So I wondered if anything was being done to extend the description to the movie theaters.
I think Mr. Reichert will take that question.
The short answer is that this bill, while it doesn't cover theater video description, there is yet another opportunity for this community to act. And it's not the subject of conversation here, but I just want to put a plug in for it. The Department of Justice has released in the last few weeks new ADA proposed regulations. They are specifically asking in these proposed regulations for comment from the disability community on whether or not, for example, there ought to be more captioned movies available, whether or not there ought to be, as they put it, narrative description movies available. And individual commenters are absolutely necessary. Right now, you know, after just, what, about 1 week, 2 weeks of having those comments up, they've had something like 300 people comment about the need for segues to be allowed, you know, in indoor facilities in the same way that, let's say, power wheelchairs are available. We need to have our community comment. So we're going to be getting more information out about those proposed rules, too. So when you see that, that's a good opportunity for all of us to comment and talk about the need for greater availability of description in theater.
I would like to thank my two guests for coming to the Marlena Donahue Show. And I hope that the audience has enjoyed it. Now, what booth number are you going to go to, audience? And what are you going to do when you get there, audience? And what is the number of the bill, audience? And what do we want to ask them to do? Sign on as a sponsor. Let's all say it together. Sign on as a sponsor. And the show is over.
Marlena.
All right. Well, now that I can be me again, I don't know, being Phil was really interesting, though. You know, today, as I said when I began the day today, what a joy it is for me to be chairing, officiating at my very first ACB General Session. And I have been very fortunate today to have worked most of the day with people I really know and people I really like a lot. And that trend continues. Next on our agenda is something about accessibilityisaright.org. When I first looked at this on the Braille note, I thought, what does this say? But accessibilityisaright.org. What is it all about? And to tell us what it's all about is my good friend and someone whose voice is very familiar to all of you, Mike Calvo, CEO of the Ceratec Corporation, all the way from Orlando, Florida. Mike? So is Mike here? Oh, I think he's coming. Did I hear he was coming? Oh, boy, that big build-up, you know. Do, 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 do. Here he is.
Oh. You're bad.
There you go.
You're
there bad. You go. I know. He says I'm bad.
She's bad. She's going to help us find the blind spot. I'm not even going to touch that. Good morning. I hope everybody's doing well. It's been an awesome conference this year, hasn't it? You know, accessibility is, I believe, and we believe at Ceratec and at the AIR Foundation, is every blind person's right to have accessibility wherever they go. At Ceratec, we've dedicated the last 7 years to doing that, to providing access to people on the go. With our award-winning products, we just won the AFB Access Award for 2008 this year for System Access to Go. Thank you, thank you. And thanks to the great folks at AFB. You know, ACB Radio has been instrumental for us in getting the word out there And we are a community of consumers. If there's one thing I want you to walk away from this conversation today understanding, is that we mean something in the big picture when it comes to finance, financial resources and financial ability. You know, a lot of us think we're a niche market. We don't matter. You know, we're very small. Forrester Research did a survey with Microsoft in 2004 that showed hundreds of millions of blind people worldwide. Of those approximately 300 million blind people, less than 1% had access to screen reader technology, and less than 5% had access to large print technology or magnification technology. I would submit to you that we haven't even had a chance to prove our economic viability yet. Today, Serotech is 7 years old. We have enjoyed a seven-year history, not from government subsidies, not from educational purchasing, but from you guys. I'm here. I'm not dressed in hand-me-downs. I'm not dressed in clothing that I have acquired from somewhere else. I bought it off the rack with green dollars that I can't read, but that's beside the point. Oops, sorry. Didn't mean to go there. But, you know, the whole thing here is that you do mean something. You have a voice. Nothing proves that more than the thousands of us that have signed up for the Serotech Summer Sizzle Contest. Who here doesn't know what the Summer Sizzle Contest is? Well, I'll tell you. In partnership with ACB Radio and the Marlena program in particular, we are giving away what we call an accessible digital lifestyle makeover. It includes an Asus EEE PC, a Victor Reader Stream, a Zenstone, a four-year software as a service package from System Access, a screen reader of your choice for your mobile device from Code Factory. And all you've got to do is give us your firstborn. Actually, I have five of my own. You guys can keep yours. As a matter of fact, if you'd like, I'll give you one of mine. Really, I mean, we've had thousands of people sign up for this contest. And really what we're doing is it's the first time that an AT company has gone out and said, what is it that you use? There's a survey up there and you answer, I use this screen reader and that technology for this and that. And you find how many people are using what. And you'd be surprised at how many people are out there buying consumer-level electronics. The thing that we need to do, folks, we need to get online. We need to stop looking at adaptive technology as a Xerox or a Kleenex. We need to start giving people the technology that fits their need. Okay? We also need to understand that adaptive technology is not a religion. Okay, if you use this product and it fits your purpose and there's another purpose in your life that'll work with that product better, by all means, if it's within your means, get it. You know, it's extremely important that people understand that accessibility is a right. And if you'd like to use a screen reader, absolutely free, go to www.satogo.com. That's www.satogo.com. That will give you a screen reader wherever you are. If you're on the road, walk up to a Windows machine, press the Windows key, press R, type that into the address bar, into the bar right there, and you will have a screen reader running on that machine temporarily until you close the window. Yours, absolutely free. If you care to buy that screen reader and other associated web services, for $24.95 a month, which is the price adaptive technology should be, where everyone can pay for their own, then you can visit serotech.com and do so. One last thing. We are announcing a program for kids. You know, we called it Project Reap within the company. And the reason is because, you know, you reap what you sow. How many of us grew up and didn't know a lot of blind folks when we were growing up? We kind of felt like we were growing up in a vacuum, you know? Yeah, I too was the blind Lone Ranger. And when I finally got online and started meeting wonderful people, like many people here that are doing stuff, that are just average folks and some really, really amazing folks, I've realized that all of us are really, really connected if we have the means to do so. That's why we want you to have SA2Go. And this is why we believe that kids need to be connected. To give children that opportunity to be able to not only use adaptive technology in a specialized resource classroom where they may visit once or twice a week or maybe once a day, you know, that special class that we all used to go to, use that blind stuff. Okay. We've done a program called Keys for K-12. What it does is it allows any of the 50,000 blind children in this country, grades K through 12, to register with their school to Serotech Corporation for a free copy of System Access Mobile until they graduate from high school. Absolutely free. We need you to let your educators know, spread it on an email list, visit serotech.com. It's serotech.com, and click on the Keys for K-12 link and register any children that you may have that are ages K through 12, okay, for their free copy of System Access, no strings attached, nothing. They're welcome to come, register for it, and if they qualify, which they got to be blind kids too, and don't you older people act like kids, don't be doing that. We'll send CBS over to ABC to your house for Nightline. Really, Keys for K-12, we really need you to spread the word. Again, www.satogo.com, SA2Go, is your free screen reader. Doesn't matter what you use. AT is not a religion, people. Let's just use what we need, right? Rock on.
Any questions for Mike?
Oh, you want me to answer questions, too?
Yeah.
Any questions?
Excuse me. Rod Chard from California. Could you spell Serotech one more time? We didn't quite get it down.
It's www.serotech, that's serotech.com. And we're in booth 58 here, by the way, if you want to come check out our new version of our software and support for VictorStream and Icon and Braille Plus and all that good stuff that we've got.
Hello?
Yes, Hi, go ahead.
This is Kelly from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, Kelly.
How do you sign up for the summer contest?
You simply visit our website at serotech.com, and there's the summer sizzle link is right up there.
Okay, so we can't do it at your booth?
No, there's too many questions.
Okay.
It asks you, it's a small survey on what you use and how your accessible digital lifestyle works.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? And let me just add that the winner of the Summer Sizzle will be drawn on ACB Radio on the Marlena program, and we will call that person live. So if our server guys are listening, get ready for a big audience the Sunday after Labor Day. All right, let's give Mike a
thank you.
Big round of applause. All right, we are very, very close to completing our session. And let us first tell our door prize ladies to be ready, ready, ready. And are there any announcements?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Mr. President has an announcement. Should I recognize him?
No.
All right, they said no. Sit down, Mitch.
Okay.
Marlena.
Yes, ma'am.
I have one more announcement when Mitch is done.
Well, all right. I'll let the gentleman from California go first.
Yes, I'm. Whoops. Hello. I think the mic just.
The other mic.
He's getting there.
There it, okay. Couple of announcements. One, which I almost, there. Eric Bridges and Mark Reichert, Eric primarily wanted me to mention that there is Braille
information, I assume there's large print as well, regarding the digital television changeover as well as on audio description. And I believe that information is available out at the registration / information desk. If I'm wrong, I'm sure someone will correct me. Also, I wanted to announce, because someone asked me to, the countries of origin of our international guests this week. We had guests from Australia, from Canada, and you heard from John Ray on Monday, from England, from India, our friend Gene Parker. In fact, Gene is not here today. She was informed she had a tomorrow morning deadline to put a program together, so she wasn't able to stay for the last day that she was going to be here originally. From Norway, and Argentina. And as well as España, Spain. And one final announcement. I have just been informed, for better or for worse, the President's Suite 446 now has voicemail. I'm not sure what that was, Karen, but if you have been wanting to leave me a message this week, or Donna for that matter, you can now do so, and now I have no excuse but to return your call. Also, Donna just brought me a message. There is the Wooden Toy People, Roger and Carol, and I don't recall their last names.
Schaff.
But Schaff, that's right. Somebody who visited them on Monday, who is female and blonde, bought a lot of toys, and one of them fell out of her purse or out of the bag, and they have it. So if you bought something from the Schaffs on Monday and you fit that general description and you believe you're missing something, come to their booth, which I believe is 47. So that's all the announcements I have for now. So I guess, Brenda, you're next.
Thank you. I was given a note by our registration desk and asked to announce that we have two more gold sponsors, both from Honolulu, Warren Toyama and Miles Tomashiro. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. All right.
Madam Chairman?
Yes?
It's Kathy Brockman from Milwaukee. I have an announcement to make.
Okay.
This is from I'm a member of the MMS committee coming to you with your daily message. There's many ways to contribute to ACB. You've been hearing Brenda recognize our wonderful convention sponsors. But for those of you who don't have a big chunk of change, you can contribute monthly, as little as $10 per month. So we'll have Lane Waters and Dina Wilson will be the registration or information desk, and I'm going to be there at 2 p.m. Please come by, and one of us will willingly help sign you up, and it's painless. The money is taken out of your charge card or your checking account. Thank you for supporting ACB.
All right. Thank you very much. Yes.
Madam Chair.
This is Nola McKinney, president of AABL.
Yes.
I just want to remind everyone of our musical wine and cheese and drawing. We are selling raffle tickets. There are cash prizes, and the wine and cheese will be flowing at 4 o'clock in the President's Suite. So please come, if you haven't registered.
I hope the cheese won't flow, but I sure hope the wine will. All right.
Wow, Marlena.
All right. Are there any other announcements?
Yes. Marlena, yes. I have some. Right.
Okay. Whoa. Okay. Do I hear Carla?
Yes.
All right, Carla.
Just some reminders. Be sure and reserve your banquet tables
by noon tomorrow, and they are tables of six. Reserve banquet tables of six at the information desk. Also, I want to again remind those of you that have not picked up your T-shirts that you paid for on the pre-registration to go by the registration desk today before 1 o'clock and pick up your shirts. They do have a list of people who still need to pick up T-shirts.
All right. And I think there was a gentleman with an announcement.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Hold on. I have one more.
I'm sorry, Carla.
I want to remind you that the Maryland, Massachusetts caucus is not published, so I want to remind you of that. It'll be in the paper for tomorrow. But that it is tomorrow, Thursday, in the Nunn Room. Finally, I promised Darian that I would also remind you again that the pizza and networking for HCBHSP is tonight in 11:46 at 5 p.m. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Carla. Now the gentleman.
Thank you. Madam Chair, this is Sam Herbert with NABS, and I just wanted to remind everybody that there's going to be comedy night this Thursday at 8:30 in the Carol Ford Room. And there is going to be a cash bar, so there's going to be some great times there. NABS will also be selling our raffle tickets for our Salsa. Oh, sorry, not Salsa raffle. It's a 50-50 raffle. I'm a bad reader here. It's going to be drawn that evening, so you might be able to make some money giving money. That's kind of an oxymoron, but it works.
All right, and the other gentleman.
Thank you, Marlena. This is Pratik Patel from New York, and we have a $1,000 check for a donation to ACB General Fund from ACB of New York.
Thank you, New York. Thank you, New York.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
This is Jay Bader again in Florida.
Yes?
I just wanted to remind everyone that we need people. There have been a lot of people that have signed up already at Booth 72. But we need as many participants as possible to sign up for usability surveys. It is not a hard booth to spot. It is right between the Leader Dogs for the Blind and Guide Dogs for the Blind booths. As you exit the hall here, as you exit the general session, there are people that are there right now. Please sign up because your participation is crucial to making this usability survey and being a part of what can happen in the next decade of treasury and currency changes. So please sign up. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
Madam Chairman.
All right. Yes.
This is Patricia Beatty on behalf of the Rehabilitation Issues Task Force. For those of you who sit on state rehab councils or want to or should do so, there are materials at the information desk about ACB's talking points on our Rehabilitation Issues white paper.
Thank you, Pat. Hearing no more announcements. Hold on. I'm being told to hold on.
I actually want to ask, is Kathy Brockman still here? One of these mics works. Is Kathy Brockman still in the room? Kathy, if at all possible, tomorrow morning, perhaps we could have a tally of the number of folks. I know that coming into the convention, we had 144 signed up for MMS. Perhaps we can have a number tomorrow morning of new signups and increased signups.
Thank you. Is this on? Thank you very much. I will look into that when I'm working there later this afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you. Also, I know Carol Ewing mentioned earlier we have DKM tickets. Donna Pomerantz also has DKM tickets, so you have no reason not to buy those tickets. All right, Marlena, you want to do some
thank
raffles?
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And are the door prize ladies ready?
We are, but if I could ask if there's a sighted volunteer to help get the prizes to people, if they could, okay. And if Brenda Dillon is still in the room, I need to see you immediately when we adjourn. The first one is a tote bag with donated by the Bluegrass Council of the Blind with bourbon chocolates and other candy inside.
Joy Rose, Lexington.
I think she's here.
Is she here? All right. Stand up so the volunteer can find you if you are able.
a Loganberger tote bag with wallet in it. And it was donated by myself, Debbie Kazuara.
Carla Rushable.
Oh, great. All right, let's do one more. One more door prize.
That's all we have for right now, because I didn't know how we were going to be doing on time.
All right. Let's do no more door prizes.
Okay.
All right. Are there any other announcements? One more. Who said yes? You need to get to the mic.
Yeah. Is Otis Stevens in the room?
Is there another announcement?
And if Jay Doudna can come up to the front after we recess.
Yes, this is Josette Kernhan. I just wanted to remind everyone that I'm doing the ice cream social tomorrow evening from 9 till midnight for science fiction, fantasy, and horror fans in the Tower Suite 1489.
All right. Thank you, Josette. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
And it's $6 in advance and $7 at the door.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the honor and the privilege of being your chair this morning. Go off, do good work, and have a wonderful day. We are in recess. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Marlena Show. No. You've been listening to the Wednesday session of the American Council of the Blind here in Louisville, Kentucky. The 47th annual convention. How about that? I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been interesting. It's been fun. But then with Marlena chairing, what do you expect? Our very own Marlena. Don't forget the Marlena Show. Mondays at 01 hours UTC. Part of the furniture of ACB Radio. Anyway, that's it for coverage of the session. We will now play another one of the GDUI podcasts. And I must apologize for having to cut the last one short, but we had to return to the convention. But if you would like to hear the podcasts, they are available from the GDUI website, www.gdui.org. Go to the podcasts link and you can download them from there. So, let's get on with it. More about puppies.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Welcome to the Guide Dog Podcast from Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California, Boring, Oregon, and on the web at guidedogs.com. Guide Dogs for the Blind uses their power of partnering to improve quality of life so that people and their dogs can realize their full potential. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and today's focus is on puppy training. Long before a blind person receives his or her dog, at absolutely no charge, I might add, years of training have gone into creating the optimal guide dog. Kay Blatchley raises puppies and is also a puppy raising leader for Guide Dogs for the Blind. Kay, what does that mean?
To be a raiser means that you get a puppy at approximately 8 to 10 weeks of age from Guide Dogs for the Blind, and you raise that puppy until the dog is 16 to 18 months old, at which time it returns to the campus for formal training. And as a leader, it is my job to help families here where I live successfully raise a guide dog puppy. I meet with them twice a month, as many times as they need me individually in between those group meetings. I'm here for support. I'm here to answer their questions. If I cannot give them the help they need, then I have a community field rep who is available to me from Guide Dogs for the Blind, and I call him and get some answers and try to help the families as they're raising a puppy.
Kay, how many puppies have you raised for Guide Dogs for the Blind?
We have raised 46 puppies.
Is that a record?
I don't think so. I think there are other people who have raised more puppies than us. Myself, with various co-raisers, have raised, including Achilles, our current puppy, 32 starter puppies for Guide Dogs for the Blind.
What's a starter puppy?
A starter puppy is a brand new puppy, fresh from the kennels, 8 to 10 weeks of age. And I keep the puppy until they are approximately 5 months of age. And during that time, I housebreak them. We finish their vaccinations. I wean them at 4 months of age from 3 meals a day to 2 meals a day. I introduce them to little socializations, short outings. They vary maybe 15 to 30 minutes long. Get the puppy used to being on a leash or a head collar, a haltie, out in public. How to go from home, do a short outing, and come back home successfully without an accident. And that's basically it. And play with them. I love playing with them. So I always have a puppy here to play with.
What are some of the greatest challenges of the job?
As a raiser, doing at least 4 or 5 puppies a year, it's trying to get to know that puppy and raise it so that I can transfer it off to someone else and it will be a successful transfer. And the dogs are then raised for another year approximately by raisers who take their dogs to work or take their dogs to college. So it's preparing a dog that's not going to be just raised in a home. It's also going to be going out. As a leader, getting to know all my raisers, what are their uniquenesses with their personalities, with their puppies. And that's probably the hardest.
It's not saying goodbye to the puppies when it's time to turn them over to the next person or bring them back to the campus?
No, because I am transferring my puppies off to another raiser who I feel like without someone like me who could put the time in at home when the puppy is a baby would not be able to have a puppy in their workplace or going with them to school. So I feel like I'm raising puppies so that other raisers with different life situations than mine can raise a puppy.
And there's Achilles now, right?
There's Achilles, yes. I also have a career change. And so he's trying to, he's playing with her. He's trying to get her to play.
And how well, and when you say a career change, you mean a dog who was either a breeder or a stud or a guide dog and
she
who is no longer.
Right. Lucerne is her name. Lucerne was a guide dog puppy. She was recalled, went back for training, and they found a medical problem. And so Lucerne was offered back to me to be a pet. And she has a new career. Lucerne is a therapy dog. And because of my time that we put in with her as a puppy, she is able to now visit people at the hospital. We go to a preschool. Children read to her at the library. Which is just fun. Fun for her. Fun for me.
And plus she teaches the ropes to the new puppies, right?
Totally. I just actually received a compliment this morning from a raiser who just received my last transfer. And she was telling me her cum is 100%. It's excellent. And I told her I really couldn't take all of that for myself because a lot of it is Lucerne. Lucerne always comes when I call, and so puppies learn, hey, something must be coming. Lucerne is going. So Lucerne is a great help. She's a great mentor. And I do use her as a mentor for other raisers' puppies. She is very calm, and a lot of times I can take her to a situation where another, maybe a younger guide dog puppy in training is not comfortable. And they can see that Lucerne is calm and takes it in stride. So there's nothing there to be scared about.
Makes sense. So. You know, for those of us who've raised puppies, the payoff for all that hard work and frustration is getting a dog that you're going to have as a pet for many years. For guide dog puppy trainers, you finish all that hard work and then you have to say goodbye. I guess the rewards are just different.
I think for me as a starter, the rewards are different. I do go to some graduations, but I don't go to all of them. Often the puppies don't remember who I am, so I try to correspond with the visually impaired recipient that's going to get my puppy. But I let the family who had the puppy last go to graduation because that's who the puppy really remembers. After they're gone from me a couple of months, most of them, if I see them again at a fun day or at a puppy event, those puppies don't remember who I am.
Which I assume you have to console yourself, but you know that they're
a little bit.
They have big horizons ahead of them. How much time, Kay, should an individual or family be able to devote to the job? I mean, people have busy lives. They work. They go to school. What is the nature of the time commitment?
The nature of the commitment is a 24/7 commitment. If you have a job, you need to take responsibility for making sure your dog is in a safe, secure place when you are gone to work, making sure they're with an individual, or making sure they are in a safe place in your home. And part-time work is wonderful. You can be gone from your puppy several hours at a time. But I would expect if you work all day, maybe you have a neighbor or someone else in our puppy raising club could come and visit your puppy in the middle part of the day. And I do, as a leader, ask my raisers to spend 30 minutes of undivided time each day with their puppy. That's one-on-one without any other pets. If you have children, spend your 30 minutes while your children are at school. But give that puppy 30 minutes of undivided attention. And during that time, you can work on commands, can play, but it is just 30 minutes one-on-one with you and your puppy.
Kay, tell us about the training. What sorts of skills do you help the puppies develop? And is it really different than good puppy training in general because they're going to be guide dogs?
It is different than good puppies in general. I begin with housebreaking a puppy, and as the puppy develops and we begin socialization, going out in public, I expect that puppy to relieve at home, be able to go with me to an ATM, in and out of the cleaners, maybe a quick trip to the post office, and get back home successfully without ever having to have relieved herself while we're out, which is different. Most people, you take your dog for a walk, but you let your dog relieve itself someplace appropriately and you clean it up, but you're out with your pet. But as a guide dog puppy, my expectation is higher, and I want to instill that right away, that when we are out working, you don't do your business. You do your business at home.
That's very interesting. I'd never thought about that, but of course, I've never seen a guide dog relieve himself or herself, and I guess it's because they're trained to do it at only certain times, right?
Right. If a visually impaired person works, then they designate a time in their day where they can walk their dog so it can be more comfortable. That is probably one of the biggest things that I stress as a leader and as a raiser, an expectation of myself, is that you are raising your puppy always for someone else.
Okay, are puppy raisers instructed on what to feed the pups and what sorts of toys they should play with?
Yes, we are instructed to feed Hill's Science Diet large breed puppy. And